Pantrex Day, I'd like to call this meeting of the Energy Policy Committee to order. Today we're going to talk about issues related to municipalization and community choice aggregation. Our first session today is 12:30 to 2. We're not voting on any bills, but we will hear presentations on four bills. And then we will reconvene the committee from 4 to 6, and from 4 to 6 we'll be voting on bills. So with that, welcome to the committee, and Ms. Glidden, go ahead. Representative Morgan, have you looked at the minutes?
Yes, I have, Madam Chair.
Do you want to move them one at a time?
Yes, I would. I would like to move the minutes from March 4, Madam Chair.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, I would like to move the minutes from March 10.
All those in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, last one here, March 11 of 2014. I would like to move those minutes. Thank you.
Representative Morgan moves the minutes from March 11th. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. Motion prevails. Finally, we have our minutes adopted. Ms. Glidden, welcome.
All right. Thank you so very much. My name is Elizabeth Glidden, and I am the Vice President of the City Council for the City of Minneapolis. I'm also the Chair of our Intergovernmental Relations Committee and a member of our city's utility franchise work group that has several policymakers as well as staff on it that is engaged in working to be part of our negotiations with utility franchise holders providing energy services in the city of Minneapolis, Xcel Energy, and CenterPoint. And I want to thank the chair and the committee for the opportunity to participate in today's hearing. I also want to thank Xcel Energy and CenterPoint, who have graciously agreed to be part of our presentation on Minneapolis's energy vision and actions, and we will hear from them a little bit later. And I also want to thank residents and business community members in Minneapolis who have been very vocal and engaged in setting high expectations in Minneapolis for an energy vision that's practical and innovative and that sets high standards for clean, reliable, and affordable energy. Minneapolis has been deliberative, practical, resourceful, and innovative in its work over several years to set a strong and clear energy vision and plans to achieve that vision. We've ensured there's coordination amongst the city in working on energy and environment issues, and we started several years ago annual tracking and transparency of our goals that we call the Minneapolis Green Print, where we share both positive and negative information that helps us get a true picture of how we're doing. In 2013, our planning work and partnerships with many organizations and agencies culminated in the Minneapolis Climate Action Plan, which was adopted by the City Council in June of 2013. And while our current adopted goal for the City of Minneapolis is not as long-term as that set by the state of Minnesota, which has an 80% emissions reduction goal by 2050. Minneapolis's goals of 15% emissions reduction by 2015 and 30% by 2025 is consistent with state goals. Developing our climate action plan helped Minneapolis deepen our partnerships with many organizations and community members committed to our energy future. And these partners included public institutions, like our schools, parks, and Hennepin County, as well as the Met Council, utility companies, business groups, and environmental advocacy organizations. The Climate Action Plan focuses on three key sections, which involve buildings, transportation, land use, and waste and recycling. And the key recommendation areas are, first, to significantly improve energy efficiency of all building stock, which includes industrial, commercial, and residential, and we have specific goals set relating to those areas. To increase use of local renewable energy, and we have a goal of 10% of total electricity to be consumed by 2025. To reduce vehicle miles traveled, and also to reduce the waste stream, which includes significantly increasing our recycling rate, as well as moving to composting and taking other actions. And this is all done, I would just say, in a national context, because all across the country there are many cities and in particular large cities that are focusing on energy conservation and environmental challenges, because many studies have shown that cities are responsible for a significant percent of global greenhouse gas emissions, perhaps as much as 70%. As of early 2011, over 120 cities and counties in the United States have climate action plans similar to that of the city of Minneapolis. And in Minnesota, 45 mayors have signed the U.S. Conference of Mayors Climate Protection Agreement in support of reducing emissions in their own cities and encouraging action at the state and federal level. I wanted to just say a few words about some initiatives that are incorporated in our climate action plan but are already underway in the city of Minneapolis. And one is involving our own public building stock, working on building efficiency. From 2009 to 2012, energy efficiency investments in city buildings have saved Minneapolis more than $6 million in energy costs. And most of those improvements were paid for with federal stimulus dollars. We want to thank the legislature for authorizing the Property Assessed Clean Energy Loan Program, or PACE, because Minneapolis has, as of 2013, approved participation with the St. Paul Port Authority in a loan program based on PACE, which already is getting business and commercial property interest in participating. Also in 2013, Minneapolis became one of several cities across the country to approve and implement a green building benchmarking ordinance. With this ordinance, we require large commercial buildings of 50,000 square feet or greater to benchmark and disclose their energy usage. And we also have partnered with public entities so that buildings that are 25,000 square feet and greater are doing those same actions. And as witnessed in other cities, disclosure of this data stimulates the marketplace and has resulted in building owners becoming more aware of their energy usage, taking cost-effective actions to increase energy efficiency, and spurring retrofitting activity, which results in jobs. We are right now about to have our second round of reporting this coming year, which would be buildings 100,000 square feet and greater. And we are partnering with BOMA and other organizations on training sessions to ensure that property owners are aware of what the reporting entails and how to take advantage of programs that can assist them in cost-efficient ways to increase their building's energy efficiency. As a result of our green benchmarking ordinance and other work, Minneapolis was selected by the Department of Energy to participate in its Energy Data Accelerator initiative in partnership with Xcel Energy. The goals of this work are to develop best practices for providing whole building data and helping to assess building customer energy usage data. And I want to thank Xcel for working with us on this initiative. The Climate Action Plan also helped clarify critical areas for focus that are essential to meeting the city and the state's goals, because energy use from the city's electric and natural gas utilities is associated with approximately 66% of community-wide emissions. So we know that partnership with our utilities is important to achieving significant progress on energy efficiency and renewable energy deployment. As well, energy is a very changing field with national, state, and local standards that are evolving so that the status quo is not an option. The city holds franchise agreements with Xcel Energy and CenterPoint Energy that expire at the end of 2014. And community conversation about these agreements sparked discussion in 2013 about the city's future energy systems and its relationship to energy utility providers. In June of 2013, the Minneapolis City Council authorized a study to develop a vision for a future energy system and potential options for achieving that vision, with a focus on how the energy future relates to our relationship with utility franchise providers of electricity and natural gas. This is called our Energy Pathways Study, which Mike Bull will present on momentarily. The study makes recommendations on various paths the city can take to achieve its goals for affordable, clean, reliable, local energy production. And these pathways include recommendations for future action by the city. It's no secret that Minneapolis had a debate about municipalization in 2013. And this was as part of our conversation about our utility franchise agreements. This debate, for some, was a reflection of a desire to explore all options that relate to our energy future. The Energy Pathways Study serves the role of formally exploring the full range of options and then presenting that information with recommendations to the City of Minneapolis. I'll note, too, that Minneapolis, as well as Xcel and CenterPoint, publicly expressed in 2013 a desire to work together to achieve the city's energy goals, as well as working together productively on how we might renew our franchise agreements together. And so I'm thankful to those providers for expressing commitment to working with us and to achieving the goals of the Climate Action Plan. Finding a way to move together, forward together, such as with the city's proposal of a formal agreement with its utility companies outlining shared goals, can be mutually beneficial, assisting the utility companies in meeting state mandated goals and targets, and helping Minneapolis to reach its climate action goals. So in close, that is what I have in terms of introduction and what the city is working on. And we're happy to move to Mr. Bull to present more details on the Energy Pathway Study.
Any questions from members? Okay, not at this time, but I'm sure later we'll have a more lively conversation when we start talking about bills. And Mr. Austin, no opening comments, just here for questions.
Madam Chair, just happy to be here. Thank you.
Nice to see you. Okay, Mr. Bull.
Thank you.
And this presentation at the outset sounds Minneapolis heavy, but every city has these same franchise issues. So as we hear the process that City of Minneapolis went through, people should be thinking about their own cities and their variety of cities that are facing these same questions. Mr. Bull.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and I'll be making a similar point by the end of my presentation. So if I don't get there, I'll try it. So you can make it now. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mike Bull, policy manager for the Center for Energy and Environment. I was also the project manager for this Energy Systems Pathway Study our team did for the City of Minneapolis. CEE provided the regulatory, technical, and policy horsepower for the Pathways project, and we contracted with the McGranchet Law Firm to provide significant legal support. McGranchet acts as general counsel for the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association and knows more, as much or more, about these issues than any firm in the state. We also brought in Brian Ross from CR Planning and Ken Campbell from Campbell Consultant to help out with key aspects of the project. Council Member Glidden summarized the context for our project very well. The city was finalizing a 15-month, very stakeholder-intensive process to complete a climate action plan that established aggressive energy efficiency and renewable energy goals for the city at a time when the franchise agreements with Xcel and CenterPoint were getting set to expire by the end of this year. And as she mentioned, this sparked a citywide conversation in 2013 about the future of energy services in the city and the city's relationship with the utilities that serve there. Soon after we began our work, it became clear that the status quo in Minneapolis was not going to allow the city to meet its aggressive clean energy goals. Under a business-as-usual approach, the city and utilities work essentially independent of one another on energy issues, except on an ad hoc basis. The one instrument where they do come together to discuss energy issues has historically been the franchise agreement, which is traditionally limited to discussions about the use of public rights of way for utility infrastructure, and then that conversation generally happens only once every 20 years or so. The city couldn't rely on the utilities alone to meet the city's energy goals. The utilities are organized to meet state and federal requirements within a strict regulatory framework. Utilities generally see the city's expectations on energy issues as something to be managed, not necessarily met. And that stance was appropriate to the previous period, characterized primarily by large central station generation and bulk power transmission lines, the overarching policy being electrification everywhere as quickly, reliably, and as cheaply as possible. But that regulatory or utility business model framework is evolving to be more responsive to customers and their choices and to communities like Minneapolis. The change is being driven by increasing cost effectiveness and reliability of distributed energy resources and by policies that facilitate local action to reduce environmental impact of energy use and consumption. In order for the city to meet its energy goals, it needed more influence or control over energy services in the city, and that's where we started with our pathways review. We took a look at four so-called pathways for the city, four separate approaches for how the city could structure its relationships to the energy utilities that serve in the city to best meet the city's energy goals. And we've listed, I'll list the four pathways in order of increasing city responsibility and control over energy services. Pathway number one was enhanced franchise agreements. This pathway could either be a single franchise agreement between the city and the utility broadened legislatively to incorporate clean energy and reliability issues, in addition to the traditional issue of compensation for use of public rights of way, or a traditional franchise agreement dealing with public rights of way coupled with a separate agreement dealing with clean energy issues. Under this pathway, the city engages on a broader set of issues, but only as part of a negotiation of an agreement once every so many years and not engaged on these issues on an ongoing basis. Pathway number two was a city utility partnership, formal ongoing collaboration between the cities and the utilities, formal to ensure that the city would, that the this effort would be sustained over time, and partnership to reflect that in order to be successful, both the city and the utilities have to act as willing partners working together to meet shared goals. And under this pathway, the city begins to take direct responsibility for planning and oversight of clean energy activities in the city on an ongoing basis shared with the utilities. The third pathway that we reviewed was community choice aggregation. It's a model that's been used in many states around the country that choose their that allow retail customers to choose their electrical suppliers. The CCA model allows municipalities to choose electric suppliers on behalf of the ratepayers within the city, leaving all other aspects of energy services to the incumbent utility, the ownership, operation, and maintenance of the distribution system, customer billing, customer service, et cetera. And under this pathway, the city takes over a major portion of energy services in the city, that of arranging for power supply. And then pathway number four is the formation of a municipal utility. Under this pathway, the city becomes the utility through a process that we all know now as municipalization, but few of us could have defined the term prior to the activity in Minneapolis this past year. And then the city would take over all aspects of energy services in the city at that under that pathway. As we looked at these four pathways, the first two, the enhanced franchise agreement and the city utility partnership pathways, afford the city some additional influence over energy services in the city, can be implemented in a relatively shorter time frame and committing fewer resources and in conjunction with the city. Whereas the other two, community choice aggregation and formation of a municipal utility, would give the city significantly more control over energy services, but it takes substantially more time, resources, and risk to implement, as well as involve a loss of utility expertise and experience and a potential increase in energy rates. So fast forwarding to our recommendations, our near-term recommendations are a blend of pathways one and two. First, negotiate a franchise agreement focused on the use of public rights of way, broadened to include targeted related issues such as reliability reporting, utility infrastructure investment, and distribution planning, and then negotiate a second agreement, which we call a clean energy agreement, in which the city agrees not to municipalize during the term of the agreement in exchange for commitments by the utilities toward helping meet the city's energy goals. This agreement would also create a formal city utility clean energy coordinating partnership made up of city and utility leaders that would meet regularly to plan and coordinate clean energy activities in the city, all of which would be within the current regulatory framework and consistent with and leverage the current state clean energy requirements. The approach requires the city to be more engaged and have more sustained responsibility with regard to energy services, requires utilities to work and coordinate with the city on an ongoing basis to meet city energy goals, allows the city to continue to benefit from utility expertise and experience in delivering energy services and clean energy programs, and helps the utilities meet their state energy efficiency and renewable energy goals by bringing both city and utility assets to bear on accelerating the implementation and uptake of utility programs within the city. We think this last point is important. If the city's aggressive clean energy goals are to be met, the city needs to bring its regulatory and relationship assets to the table to be combined with the utility expertise and utility funding for clean energy programs and projects. This clean energy coordinating partnership is potentially the beginning stages of a new utility business model, combining the assets and functions of a municipality with those of an investor-owned utility, combined and dedicated to meeting public goals and purposes. And for the longer term, we recommended that the city continue to explore community choice aggregation and municipalization so that these alternatives are more available to the city if the near-term recommendations that we've made don't prove out. The approach that we came up with for Minneapolis, we think, is both innovative and pragmatic and will increase the renewable energy and energy efficiency in the city, allowing the city to meet its goals, won't increase energy costs to Minneapolis residents and businesses or to other ratepayers in the state, since it will operate within the current regulatory framework and assist utilities in meeting their state clean energy requirements. In addition, it would put Minneapolis, XL, and CenterPoint at the forefront of a utility business model transformation that's going on around the country. Additionally, since the barriers to creating this kind of arrangement are low, it doesn't require legislative authorization or regulatory approval necessarily, it doesn't require significant commitment of resources, etc. If we can demonstrate this approach in Minneapolis, this could easily be implemented elsewhere in the state, elsewhere in the country, Madam Chair, and that is an important point. A network of cities that have developed local energy plans like Minneapolis's Climate Action Plan and then formed partnerships with their utilities to help implement those plans, we think that could be a tremendous force for clean energy and climate action. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to stand for any questions the committee might have. I'd be even happier to go sit down.
Questions from members. I just want to draw members' attention to the Minneapolis Energy Pathways packet that you have with your materials for today on page 2, showing the greenhouse gas emissions in the city, the vast majority coming from electricity consumption and natural gas consumption. It just visually explains what Councilmember Glidden said, is that if the city doesn't work with the utility, they can't really get a hold of their GHG emissions. And then to also note that on page 16, the four different pathways that Mr. Bull discussed are outlined. So, any questions from members? Okay, my understanding is next we're going to hear from Laura McCartan from Excel, and she's going to respond to the issues that have been discussed in Minneapolis over the past few months, but not really get into specific reactions to legislation proposed, and we'll get into that later. Ms. McCartan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I'm Laura McCartan. I'm Regional Vice President for State Affairs at Xcel Energy. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and also very much appreciate the invitation from Council Member Glidden and the City of Minneapolis. As you've heard, Minneapolis has strong progressive energy vision and plans, and we're excited to work with the city to help it achieve its goals. The municipalization debate of 2013 created opportunities, really, for Xcel Energy to build on our strong existing partnership with the City of Minneapolis. Our CEO, Dave Sparby, and then Mayor Rybeck exchanged what I call partnership letters that laid out in some detail specifics of how Xcel Energy and the city could work together on specific initiatives responsive to the energy's vision and plans. I believe you have copies of those letters in your packet, and if not, would be glad to share those with you. Since last fall, Xcel Energy has been working on several new energy initiatives and offerings that will help, we believe, Minneapolis advance its energy goals, and that we can extend to other customers as well. I'd like to provide just a brief overview of where we are with some of those efforts. They're at various stages of development and implementation. Some of them we haven't yet had the, or it hasn't been ripe yet to sit down and work through in some detail with the city or with our regulatory entities, but that is the path going forward. You already heard from Councilmember Glidden about the Energy Usage Data Initiative with the DOE pilot program, so that's something very exciting. We've also been working on a lot of things related to solar power, processes and initiatives and programs that will advance the city's goal of having more local renewable energy. We've been working to streamline our processes related to interconnecting solar projects. We met with the city. They gave us very clear feedback, some very useful suggestions on how we could streamline that process. We've incorporated that input as well as the similar input from other stakeholders, and we believe what we have in place is going to be much better and work for all parties much better. We've been developing the programs and filings needed to fulfill the solar energy standard passed by the legislature in 2013. Programs related to rooftop solar and solar garden initiatives. We've also been looking at something that's beyond what's required by the legislation, a new solar tariff similar to our wind source tariff. Our wind source tariff allows individual customers to make the choice to support more wind through their utility bills and paying a little bit extra. We're looking at something very similar related to solar energy development, and we're thinking we'd have that ready to file with regulators sometime this summer. All of these efforts will help promote solar installations in Minneapolis and across our service territory. And in Minneapolis specifically, just I think it was last week, there was PUC approval of a couple of grants from the Xcel Energy Renewable Development Fund totaling about $1.9 million that will help develop some significant solar projects in the city of Minneapolis. We're also working on an initiative related to street lighting, and this is responsive directly to something that was raised in the mayor's letter. We're developing a program that would support converting street lights to using new, more energy-efficient LED lights, and we think that that program will be ready to be filed with the Public Utility Commission later this summer. The last energy initiative I want to mention is something, I'll call it a customized community energy program. It's a program where Xcel Energy and a community partner can work jointly to create, implement, and promote a strategic energy plan that really suits the opportunities and the needs of a particular community. And this, I think, is very similar to something that was within the Energy Pathway Study that was delivered and accepted by the city a few weeks ago. Because Minneapolis is already a leader in laying out its energy vision and goals, we think that that's the perfect place to pilot this program, and we look forward to engaging with the city on that and perhaps rolling that out later this fall in a Minneapolis neighborhood. It really is an exciting effort that starts with the existing strong renewable and energy efficiency programs that we have in place and takes those and builds a customized comprehensive package that can apply directly to the needs of a community or neighborhood. Our partnership letter also outlines our commitment to provide city-specific information on reliability performance and service performance and also system investment plans within the city. We're looking forward to beginning an annual meeting with the city where we lay that out. We think it'll be a really productive platform for exchange of ideas and understanding going forward. On a broader note, we've achieved significant outcomes across our system under the state's energy policy, and this positions us well to help the city going forward to achieve its climate action plan and carbon reduction goals. Already today, about half of the energy we provide is from carbon-free sources, and we're on track to reduce our system carbon emissions 30% by 2020, which is even faster than the state goal. We've been the number one wind provider for 9 years, and we are going forward to increase our wind by 42% and have that operational by the end of 2015 with wind resources that are some of the lowest cost we've ever seen since we've been developing this. We announced last week plans to seek proposals for 150 megawatts of new solar projects here in the state. Looking forward to that. And all of that is built on a foundation of conservation and energy efficiency that exists today as a result of strong state policy and guidance, great execution, and customers who make the choice to take part of those energy efficiency programs. In closing, we're excited to expand our partnership with the City of Minneapolis to explore and implement new and creative ways to advance the cities, the states, and our own goals for clean, reliable, and affordable energy. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for members? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the information about the carbon-free and the plan. If the nuclear facility was decommissioned, how would that impact your proportionality of carbon-free to other sources?
Ms. McCartan.
Madam Chair, committee member, it would have a significant impact. I can't do the math in my head, but today 30% of our energy is coming from our two nuclear plants who are carbon-free. So depending upon what you replace those with, you could have a significant impact on our overall carbon profile.
Representative Quam. Any other questions from members? Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we'll hear from Eric Swanson from CenterPoint Energy. And again, a more general presentation at this point and not to any specific bills yet. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon, members. Eric Swanson from Winthrop and Weinstein, pleased to be able to appear on behalf of CenterPoint Energy today, and we too want to thank the city and Councilmember Glidden for the invitation to be part of this discussion. CenterPoint Energy, as you may know, is the largest retail natural gas provider in Minnesota. We have proudly been serving Minneapolis and other Minnesota cities for over 140 years now. We think we've developed a very good working relationship, not just with the city, but with residents, with other interested stakeholders, and we certainly look forward to the discussions ahead on franchise agreements and other issues. From CenterPoint's perspective, we have a mutual interest with the city and residents and other stakeholders in achieving the state's energy savings goals, and we've been working hard at that for a number of years now. Indeed, the company has put its money where its mouth is on this, and we do think it's important as we discuss potential new approaches to still recognize the good work that's been done to date by not just the company, certainly, but by this committee, by other legislative committees, by the nonprofits we work with, by the community organizations that we have dialogue with, by the cities that we provide in, and by our regulators at the Department of Commerce and the Public Utilities Commission. That work, collective work, has allowed CenterPoint to achieve some real milestones that have been recognized nationally as well. Recent study showed that CenterPoint's programs were among the top ranking across the nation for natural gas utilities in terms of total savings, savings per customer, and importantly, program cost per unit of energy savings delivered. And the reasons for that traces back to the work that has been called for by this body and others related to our conservation improvement programs. Three of those programs were recently recognized by the American Council on an Energy Efficient Economy as being exemplary programs. And again, that comes about not because of any monopoly on wisdom at the gas utility, but by work together with our partners, folks like CEE, other nonprofits, third-party providers, and our regulators. And over the years, that's led to some great achievements in programs such as our low-income renter research pilot project, a home energy reports project, low-income weatherization projects, and other efforts. So based on the track record that we've built up, we're confident that we're going to be able to continue to work together with the city of Minneapolis, with other cities, and achieve the results that folks are looking for, and do it in a way that really does lead to a win-win. Not just for the cities, but for their residents, for our other customers. CenterPoint certainly has always been ready, willing, and able to participate in good discussions on these issues. We think we've shown a real willingness to be innovative and creative in our approaches to these issues, and we'll bring that same commitment to the discussions going forward. As those discussions kick off, and we'll get to this a little bit more in perhaps in some of the specific bills, there are two key points that I do want to emphasize that the company will certainly be keeping in mind regardless of the bill that we're discussing at the time. One is we recognize the input that various stakeholders can have, but we want to avoid duplicative regulation. We want to avoid balkanized regulation. There is a reason that we centralized regulation in the state some 40 years ago now, and we don't want to forfeit the efficiencies and the benefits that have come from that. And, of course, we also want the ability to recover our prudently incurred costs so that we can continue doing the kind of work that we think you all want us to be doing. On the pathways study, very briefly, just a couple of observations we'd make there. One is, again, while we always want to search for new and better ways to do things, we also don't want to minimize the value that's been brought by the system that we have to date. A lot of good work has been done. If you want to call that the status quo, it makes it sound kind of boring. But the fact is the current process has brought about some very, very positive results for the company, for its customers, for the cities that we operate in. And then as far as the specifics going forward, you know, the study is a very, very interesting read. I'd commend it to you all if you have the time. It is a very thorough study that was very well done. And certainly there are a lot of ideas in there where I think we can see opportunities to work together. There are some ideas that, not surprisingly, will require further and probably vigorous discussion at times, but we'll be happy to be part of those discussions. And with that, I'll close for now.
Questions from members? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Swanson, in the packet, we received a letter from the former mayor of Minneapolis, and on the first page of that, it has a thing about Riverside being converted from coal to cleaner natural gas, and understanding the EPA's pressure in Rochester and other small coal facilities, you know, either shutting down or converting over. And this winter, I received notice to try and turn my thermostat down for a few days because of a natural gas supply. How sturdy is our infrastructure and pipeline system for delivering natural gas? And if we do convert these municipal coals to natural gas, what sort of impact on the overall supply and bandwidth might we see?
Sure.
Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, there's a lot in that question. I'll try to hit your points, but please bring me back if I missed anything. On the overall system and the integrity of the system, that certainly is ongoing work. CenterPoint is not, I don't believe, unique among Minnesota utilities that we've had to significantly increase the investment in our infrastructure. The fact is it is getting older in some parts of the system, and new state and federal regulations are demanding higher performance from us. So that has been a very big focus at the company. We feel good about the safe, reliable service we've been able to provide, but there will absolutely be increasing and significantly increasing investments in the decade or so ahead. As far as the capacity and ability of the system, you know, we experienced our first good real Minnesota winter in a long time this winter. And that did push the system in some ways that it hasn't been pushed in a while. But the system performed well throughout that. So I don't think there's cause for concern there. Certainly as we look at potentially converting more plants, there will have to be increased investment to serve those plants as well. But as far as the impact of that on the system integrity, that shouldn't be an issue. As far as the impact on pricing, that depends on a whole lot of other factors. So it's hard to speculate on that.
Any follow-up? Representative Hornstein points out that we are not done experiencing this winter yet. Chair, Representative Hornstein.
Use the past tense. I think we're reviewing two experiences.
Right, Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, since we aren't taking spring breaks here, any of us, can't we dream?
Yeah. All right. Any other questions from members for this testifier? Okay, let's move on to bills. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I know you'll be back to give some input on the bills. First up is Representative Dean with House File 1450. And my understanding is this would be the closest to full municipalization in the energy pathway studies of any of the bills, or maybe I'm wrong. Okay. Representative Dean, why don't you tell us about your bill?
Madam Chair and members, thanks for taking the time for this testimony on House File 1450. Really, I'm going to go through briefly what it would do, and then if you have some questions that I may not be able to answer, you know, we have a the city coordinator, Paul Lawson, here, who might be able to help me out. So this would actually amend Chapter 236B.36 by adding a subdivision. The chapter relates to local government and franchise fees. The bill was introduced in March of last year, and it was brought to me by the city of Minneapolis. The introduction date is important in light of the prior testimony of Councilmember Glidden and Mr. Bull, in that it precedes the actions outlined by them by several months, actually. One could say that the bill and House File 943 helped to get the energy discussion started in Minneapolis. The bill is referred to in Pathway Study as Pathway 1, the enhanced franchise. If this bill would be introduced today, it'd be probably very different because the city and the utilities have benefited from their interaction with each other over the past year. As introduced, House File 1450 would require a franchise agreement to include certain items. However, the city could, as the bill states, to affirmatively agree otherwise. So the requirements are, first, it's measures to reduce energy consumption in the city. In the last two sentences of Clause 1 require that any energy use reduction cannot be offset by increased rates or tariffs, and any use reductions achieved through efficiency measures must be reflected in reduced bills. Secondly, policies and procedures of the utility related to related to connecting alternative energies to the transmission delivery system. And third, the annual energy system maintenance schedule would be part of that. Fourth, a written annual report that analyzes the relationship between energy use in the city and the utility's obligation to meet state energy goals. And lastly, quarterly reports or on the utility system reliability within the city. The reports must include for the electric utility ranking of circuit reliability. And then there's a couple of the clauses in Subdivision 2, Section 5. Clause B of the bill permits the city to charge a fee in lieu of franchise fees if the city and the utility do not enter into a franchise agreement or the agreement expires without a timely renewal. The in-lieu fee is limited at 5% or less of the utility's gross revenue from service in the city. And Clause C, of course, allows either party to seek injunctive relief if one believes that the other is not negotiating in good faith. So that's the extent of the bill. I know we have some other testimony, but if you have some questions, we could take them now as well.
I see my friend Frank Hornstein has the more radical approach. That's fitting.
More progressive approach.
questions from members for Representative Dean. And Mr. Austin, did you want to offer anything?
Madam Chair, I would. For the record, Paul Austin, Minneapolis City Coordinator. I would just like to ask the committee to think about the following as you're thinking about these bills and about the pathway study. At the end of the day, we're all interested in an energy system that's reliable, that's inexpensive, and that causes the least amount of public health or environmental damage as possible. And so the pathway study and the conversations that Minneapolis has had with the utilities that operate in Minneapolis over the last year, along with a number of you, has all been about how you balance those three factors. And there's many different pieces to the conversation. This bill goes to the franchise agreement, which is one small piece of that conversation. But at the end of the day, it's helpful for me anyway to always remind myself, are we working in these three big zones, and how are we helping to move the ball forward in all three if possible? Thank you, ma'am.
It's my understanding, too, there were some significant concerns in the city of Minneapolis about reliability post-tornado and things like that, that the motivation for the discussions wasn't just environmental. Is that fair to say there were some concerns expressed about how fast service was coming back up after storms?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, at least to some degree, yes, that is absolutely true. We're also equally concerned about just the condition of the infrastructure. All of the infrastructure that all our major cities run on, whether it's water, utility, or other, is aging. And in addition to flat-out blackouts, there are brownouts, there are power surges. We see some of those within the city. We're working very closely with Xcel on exchanging information now and trying to understand, are there parts of the city that need more attention? Because if they do, that means the utility is going to have to be in the city right away, digging up the streets, putting in new lines, working on the system, which benefits everybody at the end. But the coordination and partnership is needed to help that work as best as possible.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I just want to introduce, I have a guest who's shadowing me today. This is Caitlin Navratil. She's a freshman in college at Bethel University, and she's been shadowing me for the day where after the Energy Committee, I'll be giving her expert advice on what not to say on Twitter. So, Madam Chair, and to the testifier, I ask this in a somewhat humorous context, but I actually ask it in a serious serious manner, and that is, before the city of Minneapolis engages in the art of or the science of upgrading energy infrastructure and maintaining, designing a reliable energy system, shouldn't the city of Minneapolis be dealing with things like potholes first and demonstrating it can deal with that before taking on advanced engineering concepts like the reliability of an electric grid?
Madam Chair, Representative, you've hit the nail on the head for the challenge of managing a city like Minneapolis. The bottom line is a city like Minneapolis gets to deal with all these issues at once, also gets to deal with health disparities, public safety, basic drinking water infrastructure, as well as planning new developments like a stadium in downtown East. So it would be nice to have the luxury to deal with these piecemeal, but at the end of the day, we get to deal with it all at the same time.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since Bethel is in my district, I just wanted to say welcome.
Thank you. All right. Any other questions for the testifiers? Otherwise, we have a little bit of testimony with concerns about the bill. I could phrase it that way. Mr. Evans, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. I want to take just a moment to review a bit of history. Prior to 1974, many of the attributes of utility service, including rates, were regulated city by city through franchise agreements. In 1974, the state adopted a fairly dramatic reform to that system, and it actually still contained in the statutes the purpose for that reform. It was necessary for the provision of adequate and reliable services at reasonable rates and to avoid wasteful duplication and disputes. It's not a direct quote, but that summarized what's currently in the statute and the reason for that broad reform. Since that reform, the Public Utilities Commission, under the policy requirements of the state legislature, have created a regulatory system that we've been following since that time and that's been built on since that time. You on this committee are all familiar with some of the things that they do: resource planning, transmission planning, routing and siting, renewable energy standards, conservation standards, service territories, and electric rates. All of those things came under state regulation as a change from what occurred prior to 1974 because the state felt it was necessary to accomplish these important purposes. In some ways, House File 1450 takes us back in time. It goes back to a time when we would have a patchwork based on a variety of different franchise agreements from city to city to city that would set out new requirements for energy efficiency, for renewable energy, for transmission and delivery systems, for maintenance of infrastructure, for keeping track of reporting requirements, for keeping track of reliability. The patchwork that would be set up could possibly conflict with each other. It could possibly conflict with state law. It could possibly conflict with state policy that's been established under the Public Utilities Commission and the state legislature since 1974. And under the terms of on line 2.5 of House File 1450, these powers within the franchise agreement would all be notwithstanding any conflicting provisions of law. So from Xcel Energy's point of view, what's missing from the bill is any kind of description other than that one sentence, which is that the city franchise agreements would control. What's missing is any description of how this patchwork of regulatory measures are going to fit on top of the extensive state regulatory measures that we currently have. And how is a utility supposed to manage the different requirements that would happen under a city franchise agreement or a variety of city franchise agreements with what's been directed by the state? A state policy, which I might add, has made Minnesota a leader in renewable energy and conservation programs across the country. Would the PUC determinations on resource planning, certificates of need, safety, reliability, and rates be required to give way to the municipal's preference as stated in a franchise agreement? And where does the state policy on renewable energy and conservation, the standards that you have set for the utilities, fit if cities are coming in with different standards under franchise agreements that utilities are supposed to comply with? None of these things make it impossible to move to that system, but it's impossible to move to that system unless it's spelled out very clearly how city and local franchise agreements would interact with this extensive set of state regulations that we've adopted over the last 40 years and which I would argue have served the state very well, not only in low-cost, reliable energy, but also in advancing renewable energy and conservation and some of the other goals that the cities have expressed. As this committee knows from past discussions that we've had, the grid was not built on a city-by-city basis. The grid was built as a large integrated system. And so things can't really happen within one municipality that doesn't have an impact on all of the surrounding municipalities. And what's missing in the bill is any description of how the cost of any of these things would be shared across municipalities or within municipalities, or what role the Public Utilities Commission would have in sorting all of that out. Those issues are going to require a great deal of study and a great deal of discussion if we're going to move to a system of putting a municipal patchwork of regulations on top of the existing regulations that we have. And we think that should take that should occur before we choose this particular strategy to go forward. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Members, let's hear from the second testifier again, who has concerns about the bill before we do questions. Mr. Swanson, and if you can be brief, then we have three more bills, and we're going to try to do 5 minutes for proponents and 5 minutes for opponents so we can fit the whole thing in. Mr. Swanson, welcome back.
Thank you again, Madam Chair, and again for the record, Eric Swanson from Winthrop & Weinstein on behalf of CenterPoint Energy. And heeding your caution, I've already axed out two of my 4 points that I was going to discuss. Recall that when I testified on the broader issue, I indicated that CenterPoint would have two main thoughts in mind: avoiding duplication or balkanization of regulation and ensuring that we have a reasonable opportunity to recover our prudently incurred costs. Those observations inform this bill as well. Two different aspects of it that I'd point out beyond what Mr. Evans pointed out. The bill as drafted had a provision that said that energy use reductions must not be offset by increased rates or special tariffs designed to recover the amounts lost as a result of new energy efficiency measures. That is very much a step backwards, in our view, from the policy direction that all of us have received from you and that's been implemented by the regulators to make sure that stakeholder interests are aligned and that companies are not harmed when they do the work that you want us to do to pursue energy conservation. So we have real concerns about that provision. And there's also a provision that talks about the commitment to annually establish and follow a written energy system maintenance schedule. This is one where I know there are good intentions, but we are concerned about the possibility of either duplicative or even conflicting regulation here. We are in constant communication with our pipeline integrity and safety regulators, both in the state and federal pipeline integrity offices. We've traditionally had a very good relationship with the cities, working through those issues, making sure that we schedule the work so that efficiencies are maintained, things like that. But we do not want to get in a situation where the work that we're doing with our state and federal regulators is somehow potentially in conflict with work that cities want us to be doing. But we'll be happy to continue discussions of these issues going forward.
We have one question from a member, Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Swanson touched on the heart of my question on lines 2.20 to 2.23, which, members, flies in the face of the fact that there is an established infrastructure over which the costs are spread to all the ratepayers. Madam Chair and members, for 80 years, increased demand over an existing infrastructure meant that rates went one direction, and that was down. Over the last 20 years, when consumption has flattened out, and I think not coincidentally, legislatures have become involved in running the utility business, rates have began to go up. So I guess my question is to the author of the bill. If this was to go forward, Representative, is there a way you could build a firewall at the border of the city of Minneapolis so that as consumption to continue to decline and they weren't allowed to pass that on to your ratepayers, that it wouldn't leak out to Shakopee or Prior Lake or even Richfield? Because that money has to come from somewhere. So could I work with you to make sure there was a firewall established, that somehow you guys would work it out and you wouldn't be leaning on us to compensate for the reduced demand?
Representative Beard's anticipating Representative Garofalo's bill. Representative Dean.
Madam Chair and Representative Beard, I don't think it's entirely possible to actually create that firewall. And excuse me, I think that ideally looking at our region is the way that we need to continue moving forward. I do understand the implications of not increasing rates as a result of reduced conservation. However, I think we really need to be cognizant that if there are adjustments, that those adjustments are in line with state and federal regulations. And there's nothing that precludes anything that I believe that happens here from still going before the PUC. Now, the ultimate decision might be something that was challenged, but I think as the work over this past several months have proven that, you know, we do have the city of Minneapolis and utility companies entering into conversations, and I believe that we will see more of these conversations throughout the state.
I appreciate very much your comments earlier that this was a conversation starter from March of last year, and a lot has changed, and if you were to reintroduce the bill today, it would look a little bit differently than it does. Representative Quam has a very short question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the author saying that we'd have to look to the region, but it makes me confused as to why then we are granting authority to municipalities if this is truly a regional thing we need to look at, and I support the statement by the author.
All right. Any closing comments, Representative Dean?
Nothing other than thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, and I look forward to continuing conversations with the utility companies in the city and possibly even including other cities in that conversation.
Thank you, Representative Dean. I think your bill's already accomplished a lot. Representative Hornstein.
I have one.
I'm sorry I called you a radical. Just a great progressive. Radical's not necessarily bad. Depends on what area you're trying to change, whether you need radical change or little change. Well, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in the interest of time, maybe I can combine my 5 minutes with one member from the community, and then hopefully it will be even less than that. So this is, members, House File 945 again. This is more of a conversation bill. It's more of a simple technical fix. It's not a lot of controversy here. just updating state laws. I thought maybe we would hold back because it may not even be necessary. Maybe we could do it voluntarily, for example. Members, this, again, is similar to Representative Dean's bill. A year ago, there was there's an ongoing effort, obviously, in Minneapolis around municipalization. So this was front and center before the city voters and city council last year. And The reason I introduced it is that six words, loss of revenue to the utility, are could be considered a major, major barrier to moving forward on municipalization. And so, therefore, that's the purpose of this bill, to see if we can work out a way in which we can move forward on municipalization without having the costs be so overwhelming to almost serve as a poison pill to moving forward. And again, the reason that Minneapolis citizens were so interested in this and continue to be interested in this is getting us more control, more say, more democracy in terms of energy decisions. And you know, we have 14% of the, as it mentions in the our executive summary of the Minneapolis report that you received in your packets. I just wanted to call your attention. 14% of the country has municipals. There are 125 in the state, including Rochester. So this is not a concept that is so far-fetched, and I think does deserve additional consideration. Now, Minneapolis has decided to move forward in more of an incremental path. The report states that this is a more of a long-term option, but it still is an option. And so, you know, to the extent that it can and should be part of the mix, we will need to figure out the cost issues associated with moving forward. So that's really the purpose of the bill, to, you know, continue the discussion around municipalization, not only in Minneapolis, but I believe communities across the state. This is not simply a Minneapolis issue. And so I think for the reasons that the citizens of Minneapolis were interested in considering this, I think there's interest in other communities. So with that, I have one testifier, Tim Springer, who is a resident of the city of Minneapolis. And many of you may know Tim. He at one time was the director of the Midtown Greenway Coalition and quite a fixture as a community activist in our city. So thank you, Tim, for coming to speak to us.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Once again, my name is Tim Springer. Thank you for your deliberations on guiding our energy future. I believe climate change is arguably the most important issue of our time. And tackling it is a huge priority for me as a Minnesota resident, as a voter, as a consumer, and as a business owner. I believe that Minnesota cities and towns deserve greater rights for self-determination on how they tackle the climate change challenge. It's critical that we break away from business as usual to do this. And the bills before you today allow a more creative approach. In particular, regarding House File 945, it corrects a problem with current statutes. As Representative Hornstein identified, there's a poison pill in this bill. The current law says that if a municipality should set up its own municipal energy utility, it would have to pay the utility that currently provides the service for lost revenue. That's like switching your cell phone provider and having to pay the previous provider you're no longer with for services that you are no longer getting from them. It's nonsensical. It has to be changed sooner or later. So I urge you to do so. And thank you again for your careful deliberations. Look forward to working with you to guide our energy future.
Thank you for coming today. Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the intent of this, but I think the analogy of it's not just about purchasing services, it's about purchasing a business. And it kind of results in a municipality being able to use the working capital of the utility as a lending bank to develop its infrastructure for them. So although you would pay for the end result of the infrastructure, there's still an awful lot of time and effort and everything that goes into that, and the reason that it's undertaken is for the sake of the future revenue. So this is not a black and white issue for me on this one.
Representative Quam. We have two testifiers with concerns about the proposed legislation. Lauren Lotteig from Otter Tail Power. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lauren Lotog, and I represent Otter Tail Power Company in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. The statute that's in question in the bill, House File 945, contains four considerations that the PUC takes into account when it decides what must a municipal utility pay for a private utility's investments. First, the original cost of the investment less depreciation. Second, the loss of revenue to the utility. Third, expenses resulting from integration of facilities. And finally, other appropriate factors that the commission deems to be of value. What's in question here is number two, the loss of revenue to the utility. So the question becomes, why does loss of revenue belong in this list? And the bill would delete it from the statute. In 2006, for the second time in our recent history, the City of Detroit Lakes exercised its right to purchase service territory from Otter Tail Power Company, service territory that we had occupied for many years and had made many investments in. And included in the calculation of the purchase price was this item number two, loss of revenues to the utility. Why does loss of revenues belong in this calculation? Well, first let me say, Otter Tail Power is a private going concern. It is a business with captive customers. Second, Otter Tail's management has made long-term decisions and commitments with respect to service to the area in question. Third, Otter Tail shareholders and its bondholders have made investments in the area subject to the annexation. Fourth, Otter Tail's customers have been obligated to pay for the fixed asset costs plus financing over a long period of years. So finally, fifth, what is the business worth? What is its going concern worth? I would suggest to the committee that is not just the net book value of the physical assets that are in place in the territory in question. Instead, if you go to business school, you learn that it's the net cash flows that it will throw off over some period of years that it will generate in the foreseeable future. In the U.S. Constitution, the Fifth Amendment, near the end of the Fifth Amendment, it contains what's known as the Takings Clause, and it has verbiage thus: nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Recently, the Minnesota Supreme Court undertook a case of the City of Moorhead versus Red River Electric Cooperative. And in that case, it interpreted the Constitution's just takings, or the takings clause and just compensation to be in this: it should have a liberal interpretation so as to effect its general purpose. And in that case, they decided in favor of Red River Electric Cooperative and the inclusion of lost revenues in its final decision. Madam Chair, that's all I've got today, but I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Why don't we hear from Mr. Johnson from MREA, and then we'll see if there's any questions. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joel Johnson. I represent the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. And my first comment, I'd like to thank the author for writing the legislation. So this is really targeted at the investor-owned utilities. But we still have really grave concerns over this issue because of the precedents that it will set. Since service territories were established in 1974, most of the municipal takings of utility services have been at electric co-ops. And we've worked for the past four decades, first with the PUC, then with the district courts, and eventually the state Supreme Court, to make sure that future compensation, that we can develop a system of compensation that's fair to all members. And the reason that future revenues is so important is our ability to borrow is based on that. And as you all know, the utility industry is intensely or is capital intensive, and we have to be able to borrow to invest in our systems. And when you start eliminating significant future revenue from our systems, it impacts our overall ability to borrow.
Thank you. Any questions from members for Representative Hornstein or any of the testifiers? Representative Hornstein, do you have some closing comments about your bill?
Well, thank you very much for the hearing, Madam Chair. And as I mentioned, this is a very long-term concern, but I think as we move forward with this discussion, we should identify barriers to municipalization and try to address those. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. I appreciate the bill because I think some of the most innovative things that are happening in the country are happening at the municipal utility level. So good conversation. Thank you. Our next bill is Representative Garofalo's bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate you allowing a hearing on this. For a moment there, I thought Peter was chairing the meeting here. I got thrown off center.
It might run more smoothly if we did that, but.
So, Madam Chair, members, we heard a lot of issues today about municipalization of energy and power agreements, and an item that has not been focused on particularly as much as I would like to see, and that is a cost, and who's going to be paying the costs of it, and if the city of Minneapolis and its residents deem it necessary to impose some additional costs on the ratepayers, I think that it's only fair that we ask them to pay for it. And so it's a very brief explanation of my bill. It requires the cities of the first class, if they choose to go this route, if they are somehow authorized by it, then that they are going to bear the cost of that. And with us today, I have a testifier to talk about how good of a bill I have.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, I missed his outstanding introduction of you because I was talking about a member who had a question, but so I missed the joke.
I didn't say a joke.
Okay.
He was complimenting his bill, Madam Chair.
Okay. Mr. Glahn, I remember you as a Pawlenty-era energy person who visited here at the legislature. I can't remember what your position was in the Pawlenty administration, but it's nice to see you again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Bill Glahn. I'm a resident of the city of Edina, and I'm here in my capacity as a private citizen. And I want to I know we're way long, but I want to take a couple of minutes to highlight a couple of things I don't think we've heard from, and that is the concept of cost causation. I am sad to say the veteran of more cost of service studies and rate proceedings than I care to recall at this point, but one of the basic principles underlying a cost of service study and creating rates for public utilities is this idea that if you are a customer class, if you cause a cost, then you should bear that cost. And the examples would be when you're allocating cost among multiple jurisdictions, and for example, Xcel Energy serves customers not just in Minnesota but also in North and South Dakota. So where you have common cost among the three states, you have to figure out a way of allocating them. Same with rate classes. You have residential, commercial, industrial, et cetera, of different flavors. And if costs are being generated, but for the consumption patterns or the actions of a group of customers, the utility wouldn't incur those costs. And those costs, through the cost causation principle, would be assigned to that customer group. And all I see Pat doing in his, or sorry, Representative Garofalo doing in his, it's been a while, in his bill is to enshrine that in the statute to make sure that the Public Utilities Commission understands that for this class of cost that we need to strictly adhere to what's a well-established rate-making principle. And I'm trying to come up with a couple of examples where this has been an issue in the past. We have some communities, some cities want to have their distribution lines underground, some above ground. This has been an issue in the past. We have some communities, some cities want to have their distribution lines underground, some above ground, and there's a perennial fight over who pays for that. And thinking of an example more on point for this, a hypothetical where Northern California is served by Pacific Gas and Electric. If the city of San Francisco wants to impose a requirement on PG&E that all electricity within the city limits be renewable, and the city of San Jose with Silicon Valley industry there ends up paying for the bulk of it, then that would create a problem for the competitiveness of industries there. And I think you would end up with the same or a very similar problem here. If Minneapolis were to go ahead under their rights under either statute or under the franchise fee to impose costs that, say, St. Cloud or Edina or Crystal aren't creating, then you would end up with that fight at the legislature, and you would have city against city because cities don't want to pay for what another city is doing, and you would end up with probably more litigation rather than less. But I think Representative Garofalo's very brief bill gets a lot of that taken care of by enshrining that cost causation principle as it applies to this class of situations. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Garofalo, should this principle apply in a case where you have maybe a group of neighbors who don't want a particular distribution line in their backyard because they think it's not pretty? Would that principle that the rest of us shouldn't have to pay for it apply in that case as well?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think the analogy is flawed because we're not talking about individual decision makers guiding public opinion. We're talking about franchise agreements that would have the power of state law. And in some cases, as was mentioned by Mr. Evans earlier on, would have a conflict with state law. So I don't think the analogy is appropriate.
I think whenever we attempt to use state law to favor a particular set of ratepayers, we should look at the equity for the rest of the ratepayers.
Well, Madam Chair, I think you are wise to point that out.
Any questions for Representative Garofalo? Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On a similar vein, Representative Garofalo, so would it be okay if, say, the city of Duluth were to do the same then? Your paragraph B appears to be rather narrowly written to apply only to some of the states and not to anybody else in the state, so I'm wondering why that is.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my experience has been that those are the most progressive communities in Minnesota that are most likely to threaten ratepayers across the state.
All right, thank you for that. Our last bill of the day is Representative Falk's bill, and I understand he has two members of the public to co-present the bill with him. Representative Falk. And if Mr. Westy and Mr. Farrell can come forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And once again, I tried to reinvent the wheel here, but Mr. Eliff has done a phenomenal job putting together a nice summary about House File 2877. And this is a bill to require the Department of Commerce to contract for a study to examine and measure the benefits, costs, and risks of authorizing Minnesota cities to directly purchase wholesale electricity for their residents and own and operate their own electric generation facilities. So this is, I would say, kind of the, you know, maybe the most appropriate first step in this process is to go out and study and see what's been done. There are other communities around the country that have allowed this type of community choice aggregation to go forward. Typically, they've been in rate deregulated climates and environments. We have a rate regulated environment, and so at least going and perhaps learning what best works and how that could potentially integrate with our system would be the first and most prudent step. With that, I have Mr. John Farrell from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance here, and I'd offer to let him testify.
Welcome to the committee. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Farrell from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, based here in Minnesota. Just a few quick comments about community choice aggregation, kind of explaining what it is and why it is worth studying. Primarily, it provides local governments a method for reducing energy costs and or greening the energy supply for their residents and small businesses. The way that the policy works in most states is that a city or county or a collection thereof can voluntarily choose to pass an ordinance or enact by a local ballot measure to create an aggregation entity. This aggregation entity then becomes responsible for purchasing electricity but not maintaining the grid for those customers. That responsibility of maintaining the grid remains with the existing delivery utility, the retail provider, and all the customers continue to pay for that share of maintaining the grid on their bill. So the bill essentially becomes split into an energy charge for electricity that's consumed and purchased, and an infrastructure charge that remains largely the same. It really is simply the principle of bulk purchasing, that a city purchasing energy on the behalf of its residential customers and small businesses can negotiate better prices when it can do that as an aggregation than those customers can individually. In most cases, those customers are automatically included in the aggregation when it's formed by a ballot measure or city ordinance, but everyone is given, in all the states, everyone has an opportunity to opt out, which on average about 3-5% of customers do. The aggregation entity, city or county or whatnot, in practice will solicit bids for supplying electricity then on behalf of those customers. And in most cases, that has been lowering energy costs for customers. Of that aggregation, on the East Coast, where it's been implemented in a few states, the savings have averaged about 10 to 14% on electricity rates, as high as 25% in the Midwest, although those have been largely on short-term contracts. And in some cases, this has resulted in much cleaner electricity for those customers. Some cities have chosen to buy 100% renewable via renewable energy credits or local purchasing. Just a quick lay of the land, it's currently in law in six states: New Jersey, California, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Ohio, and Illinois. There are hundreds of cities, counties, and other municipalities that are participating in aggregation programs representing millions of electricity customers, and they have collectively saved their customers millions of dollars in electricity costs. Thank you very much.
I just have one quick question. Are those six states deregulated states, or is it a mixture of regulated and deregulated?
California is the only state, and it has gone through sort of a deregulation and re-regulation process that would be similar in terms of the regulatory environment to Minnesota. The rest are deregulated.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Mr. Westy.
Good afternoon. My name is actually Dylan Bradford Kesty.
Sorry. I have the wrong name.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon, and thank you for your time in working on these bills about moving Minnesota energy forward. I am Dylan Bradford Kesty, representing Minneapolis Energy Options and Community Power. Minneapolis Energy Options is a community-led and community-driven campaign for clean, affordable, reliable, and local energy all across Minnesota. Minneapolis Energy Options is a coalition of 30 organizations and thousands of neighbors interested in expanding our energy options, investing in conservation, energy efficiency, and local renewable energy through collaboratively building sustainable and equitable solutions to today's problems. That is why we are here today, to discuss the opportunity in the bills before us and the potential we have to build bridges to a more sustainable and equitable future for all of Minnesota. Looking at the national and local reports, we are acutely aware that the conventional model of delivering utility services is outdated, and the status quo is no longer good enough. We can do better in Minnesota. We can do better for Minnesota entrepreneurs and businesses. We can do better by investing in Minnesota. We have the opportunity to stop importing polluting fuel and instead have local economic investment in the green energy economy. We can create jobs all across the state that are healthy and life-giving jobs that allow Minnesotans to invest in their friends and neighbors and choices that are healthy for the economy and the environment. We have had these conversations with friends and neighbors across Minnesota. Last year, Minneapolis Energy Options had hundreds of thousands of conversations and knocked over 55,000 doors in Minneapolis. We have heard loud and clear from our over 30 coalition partners and residents across the region that we want clean, affordable, reliable, and local energy options all across the state in Minnesota. We, with utility rates rising 30% in Minneapolis in the past 10 years, cost is a major concern for many residents. Reliability is a great concern for many communities and businesses. Even more, we have heard that over the past year, we want clean energy. Minnesota residents want clean, affordable, reliable, and local energy, and these bills are an avenue to get us there. We know that the interests of the corporate power companies do not align with that of the residents of Minnesota. We know that we can no longer afford the outdated and polluting technology of the corporate power companies, and we know that we can do better. We know these bills are an opportunity for Minnesota to do better. Let's invest in Minnesota's future. Let's invest in the tested and proven changes that have moved cities and states forward across the country. It's time to explore how Minnesota can achieve a clean, affordable, reliable, and local energy future that is an economic engine for the economy and is healthy for human and environmental health. It is time to do better. Thank you for your time, and I look forward to working together to do better.
Thank you, Mr. Kesty. It's been a busy last year for you.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you for your time.
Questions from members for the testifier? Okay, we have a few people who wanted to testify with concerns about the study bill, starting with Minnesota Power. I don't know who from Minnesota Power. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and your affiliation and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pat Mullen, the Vice President of Marketing and Corporate Communications for Minnesota Power, and I have the responsibility for our large power customers, our cities, and our community services that we provide. Minnesota Power serves 150 communities, and we have a franchise agreement in place with nearly 100 of them. We have strong relationships with our cities We meet regularly with our largest cities to discuss their needs and how we can really best optimize our service to them. Even though this is a study on community choice aggregation, you know, to us, it does look and feel more like a broad deregulation study. Minnesota already has a high-quality, reliable energy system that is evolving positively. Minnesota Power has an energy vision we are implementing called Energy Forward that has been widely shared with our customers and communities. Energy Forward incorporates key energy policy changes the legislature has made over the past many years and has been received favorably. The overall Energy Forward goal is to accomplish a major transition of our energy supply to one-third coal, one-third natural gas, and one-third renewable, along with distributed generation initiatives in a manner that ensures customer sustainability and high reliability. We think a study of this nature needs more stakeholder input and discussion to identify broader goals and objectives before it moves forward. It tends to have a limited view and should have one much broader, involving more stakeholders. Any move towards considering community aggregation or deregulation really needs to ask and answer some major questions, and this study does not yet include. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, Deb Bergen from Missouri River Energy Services.
Thank you, Representative Hortman. My name is Deb Bergen, and I'm with Missouri River Energy Services, a municipal power supplier. We supply supplemental power to municipal electric utilities in four states, 61 municipal electric utilities, 24 of which are located here in Minnesota. Although the bill before you would require a study of community aggregation programs specifically geared at having municipals aggregate demands of residents, our concern is it also looks at possibly aggregating the demands of a portion of residents to directly purchase energy in wholesale markets and to develop their own generation facilities. MRAS is opposing this bill because it seeks a path to community aggregation without examining whether this is a path that Minnesota should follow. We have several concerns about this bill. Although it's a study, it has a very specific end result in mind, allowing members of a community or portion of those members to directly purchase energy from wholesale providers. Such a proposal could mean that all or a portion of the city's citizens of a city, say like Laverne, one of our members, could band together and purchase power and then have Laverne Municipal Electric Service provide the distribution and transmission of that power. This scenario raises several issues that are very specific to MRAS. First of all, MRAS has secured what we call our S1 agreements. We're a supplemental power supplier. We have an agreement with each of our 61 members, including the 24 in Minnesota, to supply supplemental power. Those agreements go out to 2046, and what those agreements say is that a city like Laverne buys all of its supplemental power from MRAS. Our concern is that when you open the door to allowing a portion of those citizens to go elsewhere for wholesale power, you violate those S1 contracts. Those S1 contracts are the very basis of our municipal bonds. MRAS funds its projects through municipal bonds, which are rated just like any other bond on the market. When we lose or have the potential to lose load or to have load undercut or have our S1 contracts undercut, obviously that's a danger to our bond rating. And the next time we go to market, our bonds won't be rated as high or not as desirable. As many of you remember last year, MRS is looking at other renewable projects. Those will be funded again by municipal bonds. So if we open the door to a scenario that could undercut those bonds, again, that destroys our rating. Furthermore, this state undertook extensive studies back in the late 90s at deregulation, and it was decided at that time that that was not an area that Minnesota wanted to go into. So I would recommend that this committee start back with the work that was done in the 90s, examine that, because this is actually putting the cart before the horse. This is a form of deregulation. You need to go back and look and study intensively, is this what the state wants to do, and what does that mean for the infrastructure, the grid? How do you integrate it with MISO? How do you integrate it with the federal regulations coming down on cybersecurity, the NERC regulations, the FERC regulations? That all has to be considered. Thank you.
Thank you. And our last out-of-towner in the list is Larry Johnston. I don't know if we want to let him go before the locals. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I think I can kind of shorten a path here just a little bit. We've had a lot of similar discussions going on. I'm Larry Johnston with Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. I'm a quite similar agency to what Ms. Bergen just talked about. We serve 18 municipal utilities across the state, including some of those that have been referenced, some of the larger municipalities in the state, including Rochester. We are, in fact, in opposition to this bill for many of the reasons stated. It does seem to chart us down a path of utility deregulation. And thinking back to a couple things, one, the testimony of Mr. Evans, talking about the fact we essentially have, you know, 40 years of kind of a compact, if you will, that was put in place between the utilities and the state regulatory structure to be able to help us efficiently plan for what has become our system. And I too, kind of struggle to see whether or not we think that system is failing us. Maybe there's areas where it could be improved. There's been a number of studies with regard to regulation of the commission over the past couple years. The whole decoupling thing comes to mind in terms of things that we might be able to do better, perhaps. If you were here in 1997, when we had those discussions about deregulation, I would submit to you that upending the current system for something that might look simple in a handful of states around the country is not entirely the case. The points that Ms. Bergen points out in terms of how we integrate this with what has also been an entirely changing regulatory and delivery scheme at the national level. An earlier comment about maybe we need to think about this in terms of regions. I frequently do. Interestingly enough, the region I think about happens to be a 12-state footprint with MISO and a couple provinces, not necessarily whether or not it's something bordering Minneapolis or not. One of the things that is troubling for us is we kind of see ourselves as public power, as the original community aggregators, if you will. And so sometimes it's a bit troubling to think through this process in general. They've been aggregating their community customers for their needs and providing community power for quite some time, some of them for over 100 years. We're quite similar with MRES as well in that to be able to build that kind of infrastructure in terms of generation and transmission, we needed to be able to secure that financing long term. We've probably got $600 million worth of bonds that are totally guaranteed by the power supply contracts that we have, most of which run just a little bit longer than theirs, run through 2050. So those are things that are a concern to us, and it's not just when we go back in for a new bond offering. We sit and meet with the rating agencies on an annual basis. And consistently the comment is, where does Minnesota stand in terms of its regulation? How does it feel about deregulation? And we've been able to generally answer that question over time. This kind of upends that just a bit. So we appreciate the opportunity to discuss this with you and to continue this dialogue, but we would urge you not to upend the system and go down that path.
Mr. Black. Thank you very much for your testimony. And as long as Xcel and Otter Tail and MREA feel good about what all the other utilities have said about this bill, we can have this be the last testifier in opposition. Go ahead, Mr. Black.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be very brief. My name is Bill Black. I'm with the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. Municipal utilities, as you've heard, started aggregation of community energy choice, beginning with the choice of their citizens to provide power to their homes, churches, schools, and businesses in the first place. Today, cities with municipal utilities purchase to varying degrees the bulk or total of their power supplies from a municipal power agency, a federal power agency, a generation transmission co-op, or a utility like Xcel or Minnesota Power based on multiple local considerations. Municipal utility could and would continue to be its city's aggregator of choice, I hope, under this proposal. But the definition of community choice aggregation in this proposed study entails the wheeling of power across distribution utility power lines. Even if this were confined to non-municipal utility service territories, municipal utilities could be gravely affected. as would, we believe, the stability of the electric industry in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry that we are well over our committee time. Representative Falk, any wrapping up comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we've heard a lot of different comments from the opposition here, but, you know, let's talk about what this bill is not. It's not a mechanism to deregulate. It's a study. And I do think it's important for people to actually read the entirety of the bill and not just go and cherry-pick parts that they think supports their arguments. But this is a study that would be done by an independent consultant, and it weighs benefits, costs, and risks. And if you want to read points four, it says four the different methods that allow customers to opt out of a community choice aggregation program if they wish. Point five, the impacts on a utility providing electricity distribution to community choice aggregation program customers of removing its energy supply functions from those customers. And so we're trying to go and make sure that this is an independent study that accounts for the risks and benefits and costs that are incurred by all parties. The other thing, too, when we talk about independent consultants, and, you know, the idea of stakeholders is brought up, but oftentimes when we talk about stakeholders, it ends up just being the lobbyists, lawyers, and professional meeting attenders that we all know, and we don't truly get independence. And so that's my hope, that once again we could actually go and gather the information and then talk about the information without the process being co-opted at the onset.
Thank you, Representative Falk. Thank you, members. Sorry for keeping you 10 minutes over. This meeting is adjourned. We convene the hearing of the Energy Policy Committee. Our first bill up is Representative Daphne's bill. House File 2911.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I appreciate it. Would you be able to move the bill for me?
I would like to move Representative Daphne's bill. And I would move that it be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, House File 2911 is an attempt to update some of the tax treatment of the solar industry in Minnesota after the good work that you did last year passing the solar energy standard for investor-owned utilities. As you know, Minnesota has a policy that exempts solar photovoltaic devices from the property tax, but the definitions are outdated for the modern industry. This bill will update the language to include solar energy systems, which is a more comprehensive definition of the components necessary for solar energy generation. In addition, the bill provides for a solar energy production tax in lieu of property tax for utility-scale systems. I've gotten some concern in my own neighborhood that this might negatively impact rooftop systems that people might have. It does not. They fall well below the threshold in this bill. The bill is modeled after the wind production tax, which provides for a payment based on energy production to the host counties, cities, and townships. The solar energy production tax will be paid at the rate of $1.20 per megawatt hour for energy systems with a capacity greater than 1 megawatt. Wind pays the same rate for over 12 megawatts. 1 megawatt for solar aligns with the net metering rules that were passed last year. The owner must file reports with revenue annually detailing the energy production. If they fail to do so, the Commissioner of Revenue will determine the tax based on nameplate capacity of the system multiplied by a factor of 30%, which is punitive. The solar production taxes will be distributed 80% to counties and 20% to cities and townships. And I will, just to close before I hand it over, if I may, to my testifier, Madam Chair, had we been just a little bit faster, we would have had an amendment for this committee on page 2, line 9, to decrease that number from 60% to 30%. Because this bill was based, was modeled after the wind production tax, the number was pulled from there. A multiplier of 60% is punitive for wind, but a multiplier of 30% is equally as punitive for solar. And we're trying to parallel here. We're trying to model after each other.
Thank you, Representative Daphne. And you have a testifier.
I do. I'd like to introduce Mr. Nathan Franzen with Geronimo Energy, if I may.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nathan Franzen. I'm the Director of Solar for Geronimo Energy. We are a Edina-based wind and solar developer. We focus on large commercial and utility-scale development. I believe the representative framed up this bill very well. It's mainly a cleanup of some outdated language that we see does not reflect today's technology. And it also provides clarity to the industry about the rules of the game in terms of what we can expect in terms of paying for production taxes to the local communities. Similarly, we believe this will be a benefit to the local governments as they will clearly understand what they can expect to receive if they approve a project in their local community. So, with that, I can answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Would anybody in the audience like to testify in favor of or opposed to the bill? Seeing none, I'd renew my motion that House File 2911 be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, please say no. Motion prevails. The bill is referred to taxes.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate the consideration.
Representative Anzels. Welcome to the Energy Committee.
Good to be here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is House File 2719, and it pertains to my community of Grand Rapids and the Blandin Paper Company, currently owned by UPM Kymmene, a company from Finland. In the 2013 session of the legislature, language was passed which facilitated the permitting of a biofuel facility outside the seven-county metropolitan area, and it would exempt such a facility from the mandatory environmental impact statement. The bill before you today comes at the request of Blandin because they are interested in constructing a bio refinery, which is apparently technically different than a cellulosic biofuel facility. And so therefore the bill asks to extend the requirement, the exemption from the environmental impact statement to a bio refinery as well. And that is my understanding of the bill. I understand that in the other body there was very little objection to it, but this is the House, and I'm prepared for whatever happens.
Thank you, Representative Anzels. And I will move that your bill be re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources Policy. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify in favor of or opposed to the bill? Are there any questions from members? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 2719 be re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources Policy. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails, and you are on your way to environment policy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was really nice to be here.
It's a pleasure having you, Representative Anzels. Next up, we have Representative Morgan's House File 2918. And Representative Morgan moves that House File 2918 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Always a fun committee. Glad you get to come see us there. And I understand you have an A1 amendment. Would you like to move that to get the bill in the shape that you would like it to be, or do you want to wait and have that amendment explained later?
We'll go ahead and move that now, Madam
Chair. Okay. I'd like to move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author desires. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, this bill is a bill to provide some guidelines and rights and responsibilities for both homeowners and homeowners associations regarding the installation of solar units on the roofs of townhomes. This applies in limited application to folks who are responsible for the maintenance and insurance of the roofs. You can't have anybody living above or below you, but we think the bill will provide some opportunities for townhome owners to install solar if they like, and it also provides some guidelines for associations. We have worked with the homeowners associations addressing their issues. The amendment that we just adopted is reflects those efforts to meet their concerns. I believe we have met all of their stated concerns with that amendment, and I'd be happy to answer questions. I have a couple people in the audience here to answer questions if I can't, and I think it's a good bill, ma'am.
Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify in favor of or oppose? Representative Scott, question.
So if I get this right, you're going to you're going to require that they allow this to happen. So homeowners associations will not be able to make that decision for themselves. Is that correct?
Representative Morgan.
What the bill does is it says that if the homeowner owns the roof and is responsible for the maintenance of the roof and is responsible for repair for the roof and is responsible for the cost of insuring the roof, then those homeowners ought to have some authority over what goes on the roof. Now, we also recognize that the Town Home Association has certain guidelines and should have certain guidelines for what things look like and have some community concerns about these issues. So we have provided some restrictions on the way the solar panels, the installed solar looks, and we have also provided some protections for both the homeowners and the homeowners association. So there are rights and responsibilities on both sides, Representative Scott.
Representative Scott, follow up?
Yes. So is anyone from the Homeowners Association folks, are they here to testify that they're happy about this bill? They're fine with it?
Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, when we spoke with the Homeowners Association, we did address all the concerns that they expressed to us. They have a national policy. CAI is the group we spoke with primarily. The national policy is for them never to support these proposals. So they could not come out in support of the proposal, but we did address their concerns. There was another group we worked with, I believe it was CIC Midwest. They did not seem to express any additional concerns. I don't know if a member from that organization is here as well.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for staff, Chapter 500 of law, what body of law is that? What section? What are we looking at here? What portion, what chapters are that? Like, is it education, finance, land ownership? What is it?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, it's a section of law that's dealing with homeowners associations, condominiums, things like that.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Morgan. What other sections of law right now are given this sort of preferred or protected status regarding items that are cannot be restricted on construction of homes?
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo, I know that my wife and I used to be town homeowners, and there's federal law that requires, that allows town homeowners to install satellite dishes. For instance, townhomes cannot restrict you from installing a satellite dish. There are certain exceptions they can ask. For instance, we had to paint ours the same color as our deck, but they can't say no, you can't have a satellite dish. We also know that the Minnesota State Legislature, I believe it was in 05, passed a law that said you could not restrict the townhome owner from installing a flag, for instance. So this is certainly action that has federal and state precedents.
Representative Garofalo, that debate on the flagpole exemption was rather entertaining. I don't know if you remember that, but
I don't. I remember we voted on that. I just don't remember the debate as being entertaining, but I'll take your word for it. So in terms of state law right now, besides the U.S. flag, what other state laws do we have that have this sort of preferential status? I don't know.
Mr. Eliff?
I'm going to phone a friend, Madam Chair.
Mr. Abbey, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and give us any help you can on this question.
Ross Abbey, a policy associate at Fresh Energy. Chair, representative, something like 20 states have already taken this step of clarifying, standardizing, and rationalizing the way that homeowners can go solar, even if they're within a town home or maybe it's a single-family neighborhood and there's an HOA that controls. I would say this approach gives more benefits to the HOA side than typical in states. As Representative Morgan said, it lays out four or five different restrictions that they can apply to these systems. In addition, it says they can impose other reasonable restrictions that don't raise the system cost beyond a certain threshold or lower the system production below a certain threshold. So lots of flexibilities for the HOAs.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you. So, again, I understand other states have done it, but in Minnesota law, if we were to go to Section 500, Chapter 500, do we have other examples that we've used as a template for this to understand mistakes that have been made or things we can learn from?
Mr. Abbey.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo. I believe the flag amendment, or excuse me, the flag law is in this exact same section. The other place that this sort of law could go would be, I defer to council, obviously, but Section 515B also speaks to condominiums and homeowner associations.
Representative Garofalo.
Okay, so I mean, I'll just take it as it's my responsibility to research and find out what other, if there are any exclusions, what they are. I'm just looking at it from a learning perspective. So, and then Representative Morgan, my final question in their delete all amendment, lines 16 to 22. What is the rationale for including that cost in there? What is the in the decreasing the projected generation of energy? What is the what's the rationale for those provisions?
Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, the idea was, again, to provide some opportunities for the homeowner and the homeowners association to work out some common ground on what would be an acceptable installation without increasing the cost of the installation too high or decreasing the generation of the installation too much. So it provides some guardrails for both sides to work within to come to some common understanding.
I'm sure I fibbed. I have one more question.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. So as I read this, it says so the way this fits in here is 31 and 32, and I'll just read the entire clause. A private entity may impose other reasonable restrictions on the installation, maintenance, or use of solar energy systems, provided that those restrictions do not, and then we go to the amendment, decrease the projected generation of energy by a solar energy system by more than 20% or increase its cost by more than 20%. So obviously, as you know, with solar generation, it may not be the percentage factor you want to use. I think there'd be some sort of size limitation there. I mean, someone's proposing a 1 megawatt solar installation. There's a vast difference in a 40 kilowatt system. I'm wondering why we're using that metric and why we're using a $2,000 cost when, you know, larger systems, $2,000 in one system can be a significant percentage or a small percentage. I'm just wondering what the thought process was on those. I did not see the amendment, Madam Chair. I did not see the amendment last night online. I'm sure it was posted. It looks like the dates were on it. It's my responsibility. I missed it. If you could just explain that.
Representative Morgan or Mr. Abbey.
Let me take a stab, and then I'll let Mr. Abbey jump into Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo. We do have a requirement that they can require that the installation occur below the roof line, below the roof cap. So that would certainly affect the size of the overall size of the system as well. But I'll let Mr. Abbey answer why the numbers were chosen that we chose.
Mr. Abbey.
Chair, Representative Garofalo. Yeah, so the HOA can prevent it from going above the roof line. They can also prevent the system from going beyond the roof square footage. So, you know, the average house in Minnesota, you might be able to fit a 5 kilowatt system on the roof, maybe a little bit more if it's a little bit bigger. So that kind of gives you the price range, $5 a watt, you're looking at maybe a $25,000 system on the roof, improving the property value, that sort of thing. The 20% collar, that was actually, I believe it was New Jersey we took that from. In New Jersey, they've got a 10% collar. And we bumped it up to 20 to actually give the HOAs more discretion and more ability to change it. So to give you a couple examples, the homeowner may come with a proposal to the HOA design committee that has the solar panels propped up on the roof to achieve better production to match up with the latitude. Well, the HOA might think it looks better to have flush mounted. So under this bill, the HOA could require them to have a flush mounted on the roof. That might decrease the production by 8 or 12%, but that's allowable within these thresholds. The HOA might also say, well, you're looking to use one type of panel, polycrystalline. We think a monocrystalline is going to look better for our aesthetics. We're going to require to use that different panel. And they can do that if it's within that price and production collar.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my interest is, from reading the bill, it appears if there's a contiguous roof and there are could be structural concerns. This past winter, it was very noticeable that with large degrees of, you know, large snowfall and drifting, that you definitely could incur or cause a drift on the contiguous roof. And I don't see any protections for the other townhome owner from liability and those effects, nor any kind of consideration what might be incurred by this.
Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam. Subdivision 3 of the bill does account for that the Homeowners Association can require homeowners to, I think it's number 3, the owner or installer of a solar energy system indemnify or reimburse the private entity or its members for loss or damage caused by the installation, maintenance, use, repair, or removal of a solar energy system.
Follow-up. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wasn't asking about the Homeowners Association. I was asking for the courtesy of allowing the person that owns the other half of that structure to be able to bring up concerns and be in the discussion before installation. Sure, you can, you can replace stuff, etc., but you're running the risk of having, pictures, disruption of your home. And therefore, I would think it'd be reasonable to allow not just consideration of the homeowner's organization, but the person that you're sharing that structure with to be able to have some statutory rights to be involved in the process. And that I'm not coming up with any amendment. I'm just saying if there was a way that you could look at that and improve that, I think it would be reasonable and nicer approach.
Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, I appreciate the concern, and this was part of our conversation with the Homeowners Association. The idea is to find a balance, right? Because we're talking here only about folks who own the vertical structure and are responsible for it entirely. So how much do we want to infringe on their own personal rights of the property that they own without infringing on the rights of their neighbor's property? And I think there has to be an important balance here. I feel like we've struck that balance by having the association, on behalf of all its members, say that if you're going to do this, you are responsible for any damage, any problems that may be caused by this because of your use of this or your maintenance of this to your neighbor's roof. So I think, again, we have to find a balance, but I'd be happy to talk to you more about it if you have some concrete ideas, Representative Quam.
Other questions from members? And one more time, anybody in the audience who would like to testify in favor of or opposed to the bill? Okay, seeing none. Representative Morgan renews his motion that House File 2918 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no.
No, thank you.
The motion prevails. And next we'll have my unsession bill.
Representative Hortman, your bill, House File 2834, it looks like it is heading on to Commerce. I will move, if you don't mind, that House File 2834 be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection, Finance, and Policy. Representative Hortman, it looks like you have an amendment. Would you like to do that now or in a bit?
Yes, I think this has to do with gas lamps. So I would move the A1 amendment.
Representative Hortman moves the A1 amendment. It looks like there are a bunch of repealers there. Perhaps we should ask staff to talk a little bit about the repealers for us, Representative Hortman, or?
Or the commissioner can testify to them once we get the bill in the shape.
This is to get the bill in the shape that you want. All right. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is to get rid of all of the parts of Minnesota statute that are on the island of misfit statutory sections. So, and I have the Commissioner of Commerce to describe the Department of Commerce's unsession bill as it pertains to the area of energy.
Commissioner, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is part of the governor's initiative on unsession legislation. Just a little bit of an overview quickly. The department looked at all of its bills. I asked the staff to take a quick look at some of the provisions. The department has the largest number of statutory pages devoted to it, and you're lucky this is only a portion of everything that we looked at. We looked at condensing, consolidating, repealing, and in the energy sector, there were a few things that came up. We took the effort seriously when we first got proposals, there were some interesting things that first came through, like getting rid of telegraph regulation. I thought that this provision, the gas lamps one, is one of the top three or four that we have. We're getting rid of telegraph regulation. We're also getting rid of some obsolete rules where it's a criminal offense to have fruit containers that are not statutorily defined. And we haven't had gas lamp regulation in quite a long time in Minnesota. In the repealer section, what we have are really obsolete provisions that have already been met, or that haven't tested the time well. We have replacement programs. We have replacement and the energy centers at the University of Minnesota. We have a variety of things that are already in place, and so these are truly obsolete provisions that the department feels are unnecessary. And in the effort of unsessioned things that we recommend to the committee. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Portman.
And maybe to the committee administrator, is this still going to the Commerce Committee next?
Yes. That was the motion. Are there anybody from the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, are there any members who have any questions for Representative Portman or the commissioner?
It's just too bad we don't have a gas lamp district of the city of Minneapolis or something, so we preserve these great gas lamp regulations.
Do you have an amendment, Representative Portman?
No, I just encourage everyone to visit Vancouver, San Diego.
Representative Yarusso has a question, Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So by removing the regulations, would the gas lamp in the yard of my childhood home be able to be relit?
It's unregulated. You can do whatever you want.
I remember when we had to convert that to electricity.
Thank you, Representative Yarusso. Any other questions? Then I will renew Representative Portman's motion, or my motion, to re-refer House File 2834 to the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection, Finance, and Policy as amended. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Portman. Next up, while the chair returns to her seat, I believe we have Representative Neuberger, House File 2869.
Yeah. It will.
Was the Daphne bill
here? Have we been able to get our technology working for you, Representative Neuberger?
I hope so.
Okay, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you for having me. My name is Jim Neuberger. I'm State Rep 15B. While we're getting our video ready, I'm going to have some handouts for the members.
And Representative Neuberger, is there somebody here who would like to move your bill for you?
I believe. Madam Chair, before Representative Quam so graciously moves my bill, I would like to move the amendment to get it in the shape that I need it to be in.
Well, first we need the bill in front of us. So, Representative Quam, you would move Representative Neuberger's bill be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move that House File 2869 be moved to the Committee on Commerce.
And then would you like to move Representative Neuberger's amendment to get the bill in the shape that he would like?
Madam Chair, I would like to move the amendment designated as A14 to get the bill in the form of the author's intent.
All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Neuberger, welcome to the Energy Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the committee's time here. I'm here today to bring up a subject that we need to revisit a little bit. This is the use of coal for our energy production. I know we had an extensive discussion last session, and I'm not here today to try to change anyone's minds on what how they feel about coal. I think everyone in this committee has pretty well cemented their opinions in this matter. What I am trying to do here today, members, Madam Chair, is just bring a little awareness to a problem that has come up because of our accelerated rate of trying to move away from coal. And having some conversations, and most of the members here are familiar with what I do for a living. I'm a paramedic. I've been one for 26 years for an extremely busy ambulance service, level one trauma center. So these type of situations are not alien to me. Right now, all I'm trying to do is to say this, is we have an environmental concern with carbon dioxide, with coal plants. However you weigh in on the issue, that's neither here nor there for this topic right now. What I want to address is two factors, is safety and reliability. Currently, what Minnesota needs is a reliable baseload energy source. And I know I'm preaching to the choir. You're the experts. This is the Energy Committee. Coal right now currently meets that need for reliability. It would be hard to argue that against that point. Our other two options at this time are liquid natural gas or nuclear. At this point in the game, there really doesn't seem to be, I have not seen, to my knowledge, any expansion on either one of those fronts for nuclear or natural gas plants here in Minnesota. I could be wrong, but again, that's my research shows that. So what I want to try to do is try to get us to take a step back and take a quick look at what we're instituting here. I'm passing some maps around, and my concern is, first and foremost, my concern is safety. If we don't have any new liquid natural gas plant, and in order to bring these up, to build these, we have one of two choices. We can either build new pipelines, and as we all know, pipelines are pretty tough to come by these days. The hoops to jump through to facilitate that are arduous at best. Or we could build new nuclear plants, and I think that fits into the same category. Our only option at this point in the game is to bring in the natural gas by rail. And at this point, we have a safety concern. What I want to show the members here is a two short video clips. The first one demonstrates a train that an accident here. How do I want to get the 2-minute video? How do I bring up the volume on this? I could get some assistance on it.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Do we have some?
Still having some issues here with volume. Plug your ears, because I don't know what this is set at. As you can see, there have been just a little filler entertainment, so to speak. In the last decade, we've had four train derailments with liquid natural gas and fuel oil as well. One was up in Canada. There was a significant damage to property and loss of life. One was down in one of the southern states, I believe it was Alabama. One was just recently in North Dakota, as we're well aware of. And then we had another one about 5 years ago.
Pan back.
Coon Rapids.
We just had a huge explosion.
So.
We just had a huge explosion here.
With this, I'm just going to start right about here.
Not getting home when they expect them. This may be the cause, because they are shutting down more and more county roads around this area. I'm seeing they're moving up more water tankers to the east now, trying to get them in on these little oil field roads and stuff, and to get them staged until they find out exactly what they're going to do. They're going to have to wait for Burlington Northern to get on scene, Lance. That's the thing. They just can't rush in here and do this. They're having to wait for the Burlington Northern people to get on scene to evaluate what these cars were actually carrying. They have a manifest of what every rail car is carrying on this train, so they'll have to get that manifest and go through it and find out what cars derailed, what number on the cars derailed, what that particular car was carrying.
I want you to pay attention not to lose that bit in the details. His comment was, we have to wait for Burlington Northern to get here to figure out what it was that's burning. Oftentimes, if you wait, as an emergency responder, that's what we're told. There's a part of our protocol is to wait to find out what it actually is. If we have communities or people whose lives are in danger, we can't wait for Burlington Northern. That's not an option.
And then they can assess with the fire crews exactly how they're going to fight this thing. Lance, back to you. Look how that's blowing out now. It's blowing out more towards a horse head pump right now. So again, there's something spewing out of the bottom of that tank now. You can see it rupturing and blowing towards that horse head pump, so it's even gotten closer. Oh, we just had a pan back. We just had a huge explosion. Here. Oh, that's just incredible. Oh, luckily there wasn't no firefighters within that. Very close. I'm getting the heat off of it through my window here. This is just—it just exploded just moments ago when Kevin was zoomed in there tight. I looked out my window and it just erupted. This is incredible. I mean, Lance, we can't say how lucky we are that this happened where it happened in this rural area. If this happened in a residential area or down in the town of Luther, there's no telling what we would have lost out of this. But again, something has just exploded and just erupted in this. And it has got a fireball that is unbelievable. So again, this is what you're dealing with, Lance. This is why everybody's pulling back. They even pulled the fire trucks that were on Hogback Road about a quarter mile to a half mile away. They pulled them back now, back to Covell. So again, they're having to deal with just a major problem here until they...
Okay. That was one example here. That was recent. And there's one more I want to show you, and this is pertinent to the topic. Otherwise, I wouldn't be showing this because it was filmed in the 1980s, and it's about a minute and a half, and as soon as you see the hairstyles, you're going to chuckle. But there's a very valid point that's made in this next video that's very pertinent to what I'm trying to get at here.
Some of the most spectacular bloodies have occurred at train derailments. 1983. A wrecked train with 11 tank cars holding highly combustible materials bursts into flames near Murdoch, Illinois. She chooses to stay behind, a half mile from the flames.
The fire is making a sound like a jet liner taking off. Something apparently blew up just a couple of minutes ago and started this big roar of flames and the sound of a jetliner.
What the news crew doesn't know is that the noise they are hearing is a warning of an impending bloody carrying propane gas. Moments after the reporter signs off, 30,000 gallons of boiling propane push the tank's metal walls to the breaking point.
Okay, get the tape on. Leave it up.
The news crew feels the heat wave from the blast. Are in this blast, rockets nearly three-quarters of a mile into a field.
At the Murdoch explosion, the propane car that blevied set a record and traveled 3,640 feet.
So, Madam Chair, as you see, the blevy is just a technical term for a boiling, exploding liquid energy car that blows up. As you see, one of the things in that video was they talked about that was one car, that one train car that carries 30,000 gallons. That was just one, and it was thrown over 3,000 feet. The concern that I have right now is as we move towards natural gas and looking at natural gas as a sustainable or as an alternative to coal, if we're not building pipelines, we're going to have to ship this in by train. I did my homework on this, and I called a number of fire chiefs, and since they're not here to testify, I can provide you with their details later, but I will tell you this. These were the comments that were made. It's an absolute nightmare, and that this type of accident is completely alien to them. I asked them, I said, just describe to me in a nutshell what we're looking at here. And if we go to liquid natural gas, compressed liquid natural gas power generation for base load supply to replace coal, we're looking at 110 cars. They're called unit trains. There's 110 cars on each one. Each car carries 30,000 gallons of liquid natural gas, for compressed liquid natural gas. That one 1980s video shows what one car exploding would do. If we have a chain reaction and we get 110 cars exploding, especially if we do it in an area that has any population base, we're looking at a catastrophe. So what I'm urging with all my heart the committee consider is that in our rush to take coal and get rid of it, that we just take a step back and we say, you know, what's the most safest route to take at this time? And right now we don't have to do anything. If we maintain where we are at, and I researched, some of you are wondering, where did I come up with that 40% number for the amendment? I had spoken to some of my friends on the Energy Committee in the Senate, and basically the number that was given to me was 40%. If we stay at 40%, we don't change anything, and the safety factor stays as it is today. We aren't putting people at risk. And as you look, I passed out those rail maps. All of us, every single one of us, will be affected by this in one way, shape, or form. You have these rail lines that go through your districts. They go through mine. There's a major rail line, Burlington Northern, that goes one car every 30 minutes that basically spans the spine of Minnesota if you look at the Highway 10 route. Simply put, and I'm going to close this up with two things, and then I'll leave it up to questions for the members and Madam Chair, is when I spoke to the fire chiefs, the consensus was if we have one of these gas trains go up, a unit train, 110 cars, 30,000 gallons of this stuff, picture this, it's going 60 miles an hour, and it's twice a day through central Minnesota. If one of these goes up, it's a catastrophe. If we have a coal train derailment, you get out a broom and you sweep it up. There's the difference, the safety difference is astronomical. And I was encouraged to see that Representative Hornstein is offering a safety bill. And I read the bill, and it's a good bill. It's 3134. And I'm glad that you brought that forward. I had the firefighters in my office, and all of us got this, and they're pushing for this. And I think that this is a necessary thing. But what 3134 does is it addresses a potential accident. It doesn't prevent the potential problem. When we have these unit trains going through at an increased rate, as we decrease coal and increase gas, we're going to need more trains. 110 cars, 30,000 gallons each, moving at 60 miles an hour. The frequency is going to pick up. They're going to be going through your district. They're going to be going through my district. They're going to be going through all of our districts potentially. So what we need to do as a legislator is just take a quick step back and say, okay, I get the environmental argument. I get that. We all have our opinions in that. But what I'm trying to say is that we need to step back and look at it through the lens of reliable baseline or base load power and safety as well. We have an opportunity simply by keeping where we're at until we can get our heads around this problem and solve this. But as these standards start to unfold, we've got less than 6 years, members. 6 years, actually 5.5 years before we start changing our standards. So we really need to take a step back and address the reliability issue and the safety issue with that. And I thank you for your time, Madam Chair. And with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Representative Neuberger. We have some testifiers who signed up to testify against your bill. Thank First you. One is Joel Johnson from MREA. Mr. Johnson,
thank
welcome
you,
back.
Members of the committee, first off, I just want to thank Representative Neuberger for at least raising this issue and the concerns over putting all of our particularly baseload eggs into one basket. As electric co-ops, we support coal. We think coal is going to play an important part of our energy mix for years to come. We think it helps us be more energy independent as a country, and that we're learning ways to burn it cleaner and more efficiently as we go on. However, we do oppose this bill because we, you know, it sets a mandate, and we don't support mandates when it comes to energy. We think that's best left to each individual utility, and that is why we oppose the bill. However, I do think we need to continue to have this conversation of how we're going to meet our particularly baseload energy needs in the future. Thank you.
Mr. Fay from the Sierra Club. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members. My name is Justin Fay. I'm here today on behalf of the North Star Chapter of the Sierra Club. I appreciate the opportunity to share just a couple of brief thoughts in response to House File 2869. I also want to start out by thanking Representative Neuberger for bringing this forward and for using his time in front of the committee to highlight a really important issue, which is the safety concerns related to the shipment of fossil fuels by both rail and pipeline. We look forward to having that conversation with the legislature, and particularly as Representative Hornstein's bill, we hope, begins to move through the process. We look forward to participating in that discussion. I do want to share just a couple of thoughts about the bill itself and the direction that it suggests, and share with you a little bit of information or recent research on the health and environmental impacts of coal. Coal presents a number of risks to the public. Electricity generation from coal is the largest source of carbon pollution in Minnesota, a primary contributor to global climate change, and the largest source of mercury pollution, which is particularly toxic to young children and infants. Minnesota's largest coal plant is the Sherco coal plant, which is located in Becker, Minnesota. Some of the figures from this plant alone are pretty alarming. On an annual basis, Sherco emits 14.5 million tons of carbon dioxide, 440 pounds of mercury, 12,000 tons of nitrogen oxides, and 20,000 tons of sulfur dioxide. And this pollution has real consequences for public health. A recent study by the Clean Air Task Force found that particle pollution from Sherco alone leads to an estimated 1,600 asthma attacks, 150 heart attacks, and 92 fatalities annually. Coal pollution has an economic cost to Minnesotans as well. Another study that was released this fall from researchers at the University of Minnesota found that total damages from electricity generation in the state of Minnesota from impacts to human health and the environment are estimated at about roughly $2 billion annually. These damages include $870 million annually from criteria air pollutants and $1.2 billion from greenhouse gas emissions. Both of these studies are publicly available, and I'd be happy to provide them for members of the committee if they'd be of interest. And I'd actually suggest if the chair would be interested at a future date, since these researchers are located here, this might make for an interesting hearing at some point in the future. In summary, we believe that state policy should guide us away from the costs of coal and towards generation from energy sources that are less damaging and more economically advantageous to Minnesota. This is the path that state policy is currently following, and we believe that House File 2869 would take us in the wrong direction. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Neuberger, as far as I can tell, neither of those videos was natural gas. Is that correct?
Thank you, Representative Yaruso. The one from the 1980s was natural gas.
They said propane.
And I stand corrected.
That one's propane, the other one's fuel oil.
Representative Neuberger.
Regardless, in my conversations with the fire officials, compressed liquid natural gas is as flammable, if not more flammable and more combustible than propane. It's almost an equal match. If you want me to, I can dig around on the internet and find a 30,000-gallon liquid natural gas car explosion, but I'm going to tell you right now it's going to look almost identical.
Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree. It's also explosive. It won't look quite as identical because it won't have the kind of smoke that we saw from those, so it won't make pretty video as much. One of the things that we can take into account also, though, is that every year there are dozens of deaths in this country in coal production. It's one of our most hazardous industries. And so although those deaths happen somewhere else, they happen all the time, year after year, year in, year out. Some years are worse than others, depending on what kind of accident they've had. But the coal mining industry is still one of our most hazardous. It's not like it used to be, but it ranks right up there when people look at the death rates per worker. So we don't want to have local catastrophes, but I don't want us to think that coal is completely safe because we manage to displace the hazard to somebody else somewhere else.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question is to Mr. Fry. And a statement was made in regards to coal being the largest contributor of mercury in the state. And with the new standards for scrubbing and cleaning out mercury emissions, I'd like to understand the current emissions per year and also have that compared to the millions of compact fluorescents that find its way into disposal in Minnesota, since the lifetime expectancy is much less than anticipated. And so over 90% of those that are disposed of are finding themselves not properly recycled and disposed of. So I'd like to have you tell me, what is the annual contribution from the compact fluorescence and then from the coal after the increased regulations, and have that sort of, if you've got a trending, or, you know, I want to be enlightened.
Mr. Fay.
Sure. The figures I shared from you, I believe, were from 2012 data. So it's 1 year, and it was specific to the Sherco plant. It was 440 pounds of mercury. The claim I had made was that was the largest individual contributor of mercury pollution in the state. As far as what the comparison would be between that coal plant or the coal industry more generally and mercury contamination from CFLs, I don't have that data with me. I'd be happy to try to get you something on that.
Representative Kwan, I carried a bill on recycling of compact fluorescents, and we did the math. I think if everybody smashed all their compact fluorescents, it's a tiny amount of mercury compared to the emissions from the coal plants. Representative Kwan.
Madam.
Of compact fluorescents, and we did the math. I think if everybody smashed all their compact fluorescents, it's a tiny amount of mercury compared to the emissions from the coal plants. Representative Kwan.
Madam Chair, I when I was on the Combined Energy Committee, there was the Environment Natural Resources Committee before it split out and became energy. This topic did come up. And the math that I calculated out using information from the testifier, I believe it was from the Minnesota Pollution Control, that would not be a correct statement because of the actual, you know, we had like 16 or 17% recycling, but that was figuring on life expectancy that was stated for at least twice, if not three or four times, the length that the actual lifetime is in Minnesota. And
Representative
Palm,
I think the science is really clear on this point. They're not even close. The amount of energy that you save by using fluorescence avoids so much mercury that even if you smashed the bulb and you were done with it, you'd still be ahead of the game on mercury. Do you have another question for Mr. Fay?
Well, no, I just was disappointed he didn't have the information to compare, but I'll ask questions later.
Okay, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the first of all, I want to thank you for giving this bill a hearing, because for multiple decades we've heard there's been an all-out assault on coal nationwide in this state, and I think it's important to understand the important role that coal plays in our energy portfolio and where it's going to be going forward. So I compliment you on that. The question I have for the testifier, I have a chart up here from MISO. right now? My first question is, I thought the mercury thing we took care of in 2006. Didn't we pass a bill 134-0 that like reduced mercury emissions by over 90%? Wasn't that?
We reduced them tremendously, but there's still plenty of mercury going out of the smokestacks. Representative Garofalo.
And again, was it like 90% that we reduced it by? 90 or 90? I'm looking at,
Mr. Okay. Eliff is nodding. And
okay, so 93.
Okay. He'd be the guy who probably wrote it, so okay. I trust his head nod on that one.
Excellent job. You got 134 of us to agree on one bill. That was incredible. Even Cranky voted for it. My question to the testifier is, I have a chart up here for the MISO region, and what it is, it's in real time. Every 5 minutes, it shows where the MISO region is getting its power from. And so, do you have an educated guess on what that number shows right now for coal in the entire MISO region?
Mr. Fay.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, without having the chart in front of me, I couldn't tell you for the MISO region. I can tell you that annually, coal represents somewhere between 50 and 53% of power generation in Minnesota currently.
Mm-hmm. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Madam Chair, my apologies. The right now, as of 4:55 Central Time, 68.8% of the power in MISO is coming from coal. And my question to you is that you've laid out some of the costs of coal, but that's right now it's 50,000 megawatts that is being distributed into the MISO region. What is if coal is this bad, and if Representative Neuberger's wrong that coal doesn't deserve a role in our portfolio, how do we make that up? How do we maintain that large of an energy system? Energy source, how do we lose that? How do we possibly replace that?
Mr. Fay.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, let me be really clear. Nobody, least of all my organization, is suggesting that all of the coal plants in MISO or elsewhere are being shut off tomorrow and leaving a 68% gap in our energy generation. That 68% number, if we would have gone back 10 years ago, I don't want to hazard a guess, but it certainly would have been higher than it currently is. What we see for Minnesota and for the Midwest more generally is a transition over many years from a system that is largely based on coal and not a whole lot else to one that's based on a suite of different sources of generation that each have their strengths and weaknesses, including wind, including solar, including much more emphasis and investment in energy efficiency, and, you know, of course, hopefully many other great ideas that are yet to emerge.
Manager. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you are correct that the energy portfolio has changed. This wonderful revolution in fracking that we're having in North Dakota and other parts of the country has allowed the natural gas, the prices of natural gas to plummet and for us to use it in a more environmentally responsible way, but it's also lower cost. There's great benefits to it. But as Representative Neuberger has laid out, if we're not going to build pipelines, if we're not going to allow the safe transport of that fuel, I mean, we're going to need coal. And when I look at this, portfolio for the entire MISO region, I see 69% of coal. I see 14.5% for natural gas, about 7.8% for nuclear, and wind is 7.6%. So even if the amount of wind was to double, if we doubled the amount of wind in the entire MISO region, we're basically at where natural gas is right now. I bring this up just to have a relevant conversation about it, that certainly we want to produce the most safe, reliable energy, as Representative Neuberger is saying, in a cost-effective fashion. But I don't think that decommissioning Minnesota's coal-fired power plants is in the best interest of ratepayers. I don't think it's in the best interest of the environment, and it's certainly not in the best interest of the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Representative Beer.
Madam Chair, I wasn't going to say much on this issue or this bill at this time because we could have and I hope you do after deadlines, have a long and vigorous discussion about the portfolio and who does what and how dangerous it is and what the benefits are. But the gentleman just asserted that Sierra Club is not proposing shutting down coal-fired power plants tomorrow. Tomorrow might be a bit of a stretch, but the day after is not a stretch. Beyond Coal is your primary campaign across the nation, Mr. Fry, is it? Or
Fay?
They've been very aggressive. Your organization, in concert with others, have spent millions of dollars taking out legislators and politicians who don't toe the line and putting up obstacles and roadblocks to the construction or rehabilitation of coal plants. And I can point to six of them. in my home county in central Pennsylvania that are being shut down because primarily of the activities of your organization in concert with the EPA through private emails that are off the public record. They're going to shut down 3,600 megawatts of power next April in central Pennsylvania. It's all part of the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign, very active campaign, so I just wanted to take issue with that comment, Madam Chair. And with that, I have to get up and leave. Don't take it personally, but I have an event in Shakopee I need to be to in 57 minutes.
So. And we have one more bill on the agenda. It's Representative Quam. So if people are pretty much ready to wrap this up, we can take a vote. Representative Hornstein.
Well, thank you very much. And Representative Neuberger, we don't need to come, Representative Quam, to the Energy Committee because he just presented my bill. So, no, I really appreciated your presentation. And I share your concerns and would love to continue to work on the safety piece of it. The reality is that there's very little jurisdiction we have at the state level over the train safety. A lot of that's federal, but what I'm trying to do is see what we can do for our emergency responders locally. And your point about not relying entirely on the private sector to take care of this, or the comment in the thing, Burlington Northern, or your comment that Burlington Northern, we can't wait for them to come. We have to have resources for our responders locally in their own communities. But I do share some of the concerns that have been raised about, having a coal standard. And I do believe that we're making a lot of progress towards renewables. I think the renewable energy standard that we passed in 2007, we've met and exceeded those standards. We're moving in that direction. And I think we've got to continue to move in that direction, give that a shot. I think this sort of, could impede that progress. So for that reason, I'll be voting no.
Representative Urso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just, in the midst of the claims of the safety of pipelines, just wanted to remind people that in 1986, we had a pipeline explosion in my district in a neighborhood running right through it. So pipelines are not... without their hazards also.
All right. Representative Quam renews his motion that House File 2869, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, please say no.
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 Sorry, the motion does not prevail.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Representative Neuberger, I knew that was the result, but I know as a minority member, sometimes you want to have your bills heard. So, Representative Quam. And Representative Quam, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. Just a clarification, though, Madam Chair. Early on in this committee, there was a bill I queried us about that because it was just the PUC in their jurisdiction that it went to the general registry. I have no problem with having this go to government operations. I'm just trying to understand the logic since some PUC bills go straight to the floor and others apparently is it the Chair Nelson wishing it or
Representative Quam, your bill will be referred to, if it passes out of this committee, the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection, Finance and Policy, because there is a fiscal note, because you're asking the PUC to generate reports for the legislature, and the fiscal jurisdiction over this area is in Representative Atkins' committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for that clarification. So, Madam Chair, I would like to move House File 2828 be approved and move on to the Commerce Committee.
And the new verbiage is re-referred. We don't pass anything anymore. We just re-refer. So, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And basically, this bill didn't come about from any entity asking for it or querying for it. Came about because the first day that we were back for session, we suspended rules and we took care of a crisis appropriately to address that was caused by the propane shortage or the problems with distribution. And we increased the funds for low-income households for heating assistance. And at that time, I queried before session if there were any amendments to address the long-term infrastructure concerns to try and alleviate and prevent future crises of this type. There were none. And on the floor, I praised the effort and queried that members keep in mind that we should look at avoiding the crises in the future and try and see if there's anything we can do for the addressing the infrastructure. And there was some discussion. So that's why this wasn't brought by or for the promotion of any existing or planned project. It was with the intent to take this first step to try and improve the infrastructure, make it easier to improve our infrastructure and prevent supply issues. I was saved from showing video similar to what was in the Transportation Committee and we saw in the previous bill by the previous bill showing it. I think that since in the last decade there's been a 60% drop in releases from pipelines and that we've learned technology-wise and approach-wise in engineering how to do things better, that is a safer way. It does give us better bandwidth on the rails and on the highways. And that is the intent of this bill. And the implementation, you might notice the language is very similar to what was utilized a few years ago when leaders in both parties and both chambers and the administration pushed and heralded through permitting reform. It was to realize that government should look at its processes and improve them to not just approve, but to, in a timely fashion, not approve so that we don't waste time with a project that's not going to go forward or make it a hassle if a project is going to go forward. And so it's a very, very small bill, just a couple pages, and I'm very open to discussion or improvement because I think we need to take a first step in preventing what we saw this past winter. Unfortunately, I don't think we've lost any lives, but those kind of things can happen in the old-fashioned winters, as I think was mentioned earlier in this committee. And so I understand there are a couple of testifiers, and so I will let them come forward and stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Mr. George, welcome to the committee.
Good to see you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good to see you.
Committee members, my name is Jason George. I'm the Legislative and Political Director for the Operating Engineers, Local 49. We represent 13,000 heavy equipment operators, and a lot of whom, a couple thousand, I believe, make their living building and maintaining our pipelines in this state and across the country. These are good-paying jobs, middle-class jobs, that come with world-class health care and a pension that's well-funded that brings retirement security. We support House File 2828 and applaud Representative Quam and others for trying to work on ways to streamline the permitting process for pipelines. I know that the governor, this committee, and a solid bipartisan majority have expressed interest in seeing our environmental permitting system streamlined in the past, and a lot of work has been done on that. We think this bill fits with those goals. Pipelines are a critical part of our infrastructure. They are the safest way to bring oil, natural gas, and other natural resources to market and ultimately to the people of Minnesota. There are thousands of miles of existing pipeline infrastructure that are effectively and safely doing so right now. But with the exciting new discoveries of American energy happening in our region, we are in great need of upgrades to the current system and additional capacity. Our members have been putting pipelines in the ground for decades, in some cases 100 years or more. Some of them are literally 100 years old. In a process that's squarely focused on worker safety and protecting the environment. This is not a new industry. We believe the because of the existing expertise that has been obtained over the decades, that there is room to streamline this process. Getting projects permitted in a more timely fashion will mean that workers can get started earning paychecks quicker, and that Minnesotans can continue to get their energy needs met in a cost-effective way. Our members and the tens of thousands of other pipeline workers in this country have watched in frustration the last 5 years of political drama on the Keystone XL pipeline. We do not want to see that kind of unnecessary politicization, I knew I was going to screw that word up, of pipeline infrastructure happen in Minnesota. I think we've successfully avoided that here over the years, and we want to make sure it stays that way. I think this bill is an attempt to make sure that we have a streamlined and effective permitting process that takes politics out of the equation. That is a good thing for the people of Minnesota that rely on the energy that comes to us from our pipeline system, and it allows the thousands of Minnesotans that build this system an opportunity to know that they'll have jobs in the future. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. George, just curious, do you still have people on the bench when it comes to this in the pipe fitting realm?
Mr. George.
Representative Scott, Madam Chair, yes. There, obviously, if we could get Keystone approved, those people would get off the bench. But we're seeing an uptick in backlog in pipeline projects, and it is a concern for us. That's why I'm here testifying in favor of this bill.
Representative
Scott. Madam Chair, thank you. Are any of those people women?
Mr. George.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, yes.
So, Madam Chair, Scott. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. George. So you're saying that this would be a good program for, say, the Women's Economic Security Act. Maybe we put a few more women back together or back to work if we could get some of this permitting sped up, in particular, of course, with the Keystone.
Mr. George.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, not familiar with that act, but I can tell you that there are more and more women that are involved in our industry every day, and there's lots of them sitting at home right now.
And Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what would be the average wage that these women would be earning if they're working?
Mr. George.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, it varies, but the typical, these are solid middle-class wages, $25, $30 an hour on the paycheck is pretty typical. That does not even include, you know, family health care coverage and a pension.
Thank you.
Representative Scott. Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll save my concerns about the bill for later, but I have a question for Mr. George. I love the idea of 49ers maintaining pipelines, not necessarily building new ones, but how many, and the reason I say that, members, is to echo Representative Yarusso's comments, there are issues with pipelines safety as well, transporting oil, and there was a huge spill in the Kalamazoo River, for example, several years ago. But how many of these jobs do you, are typically, how many do you, 49ers are employed in maintaining and repairing pipelines?
Mr. George.
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, our members work not only in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, which is our jurisdiction, but 49ers are in demand across the country. So across the country, every day there's 49ers maintaining, fixing existing pipelines. It's the jobs of installing them are very good. We support them strongly. I disagree with you on that. But the jobs of maintaining the existing pipeline are also very good jobs. They're continuing need of maintenance, and our members do that as well.
And okay, so one last question, Madam Chair. So in Minnesota, how many 49ers are employed now in maintenance functions?
Mr. George.
Madam Chair, it's hard to say off the top of my head. I can get you more specific numbers maybe, but there's a couple thousand members that work in this industry, and they're not always building new pipelines. As a matter of fact, in our region, we haven't done a lot of that lately. So they're maintaining a lot of pipelines.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, I just...
We have two other testifiers, too.
Oh, then I can wait. That's fine.
Okay. I mean, if your question's for Mr. George, though, feel free to go ahead.
Oh, I have lots of questions for Mr. George. It's more of a comment.
Representative Garofalo.
Representative Quam's bill, and I'll wait till later.
Okay. Our next testifier, I think, is Dan Larson. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Dan Larson, here today representing on behalf of the American Petroleum Institute, and we represent nearly 600 major domestic petroleum producers, companies, pipelines, and associated industries. API supports House File 2828. Let me begin my comments by saying you do not have the A team today. But you will have compelling testimony. It's the person that you wanted here, the person with depth, could not make it. So I contract with API to watch things for them in the state. So thank you again. In these days when infrastructure and aging bridges, farm-to-market roads and rail lines and pipelines are only as reliable as their maintenance schedule or the frequency with which they are replaced by newer, equipment and technology. The video was compelling to me. Pipelines are safe. You've heard the testimony. Just this morning, in a different location, I heard a presentation by one of our member companies, who said they during the past 10 years. That company delivered almost 13 billion barrels of crude oil and liquids with a safety record by pipeline with a safety record of 99.9993%. So I thought that was again a pretty compelling testament to the safety of pipelines. I think we all agree that government should encourage private investment in infrastructure upgrades, and particularly when they promise better performance and reliability. But such is the case with petroleum pipelines, which are subject to extensive rigorous and oversight when the need for the pipeline is initially determined. So from that point forward, it would seem that the state of Minnesota should do everything possible to expedite repair and replacement for a line whose service has already been deemed necessary. House File 2828 would put Minnesota in position to create jobs, meet the ever-growing demands of historic domestic oil production, and provide the public with the peace of mind in knowing that pipeline improvements can proceed without unnecessary government interference or delay. I took notice of Representative Scott's point on the jobs for women. We are actively seeking, not on the women's side of things, but on the minority side of things. We anticipate that between and because of this growth in oil and natural gas and domestic oil and natural gas in the jobs and the economy, we anticipate 300,000 new jobs between now and the year 2020, and that 29% of those 3,000 jobs, or 89,000 jobs, we anticipate will go to Latinos and African Americans. We are actively seeking out the minority involvement in this, and if you look at what the unemployment rate is for that demographic, we think we can be a real answer to that. And so we're working with people like Jason George, the labor unions. We're getting together with a number of people to highlight the profile, recognize what the cultural differences are, put an idea out there for these young minorities that you can have a job and you can have a career and make upwards of in the upper 90s and even six-figure salaries and be secure. So we think this is a tremendous opportunity. Our member companies wanted me to mention some specific things today. So those points are: there is a need for clarity and regulatory certainty on the timeline for deeming applications complete. Applications in the past were deemed complete within a two-week time frame and approved within the 12-month statutory deadline. Now applications are pending for several weeks with no expectation of when approval may be obtained. And as an example, why is an application now going to public notice for completeness? This should be a staff decision, as the process has numerous opportunities for public comment. There are no guidelines published as to what is required to meet criteria, and there is no longer an ability to rely on past practice or precedent to know whether information is sufficient. A streamlined process is needed for maintenance work activities within an applicant's existing, previously disturbed, and permitted pipeline corridor. not on its existing right-of-way. Two more points. Certificate of needs should not be required for replacement of an existing pipeline and associated facilities already determined to be in the public interest. And my last point, Madam Chair, a certificate of need should not be required to increase the capacity of an existing interstate common carrier pipeline. The existing pipeline is either grandfathered or already determined to be in the public interest. A second public convenience and necessity determination overburdens the PUC, its staff, and the applicant. Moreover, it is not to be required for an interstate, or it should not be required for an interstate common carrier pipeline because any resulting rate adjustment due to the added capital cost must be found to be just and reasonable by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, its regulator. So that concludes my testimony, Madam Chair. I hope you don't have a lot of deep questions.
Thank you. Why don't we hear from our last testifier, Mr. Wolf from the Public Utilities Commission. Give us some background information. And Representative Quam, the reason I decided to hear your bill was twofold. One, I've carried the permitting efficiency bills in 09 and 10 and supported House File 1 in 2011. And I like the idea, the theory of permitting within 150 days. When I started to scratch the surface, so that was the first reason. The second reason is, as a minority member, when you serve on a committee for 2 years, you should have an opportunity to have your bills heard, even if the chair doesn't like them. And plans to vote against them. But when I dug in a little further on this issue, and I think Saturday's Star Tribune was a really timely article on pipeline permitting in the state of Minnesota, and the real struggle is between giving the public an opportunity to have input and trying to get a quick determination. And so I asked Mr. Wolf if he would provide us with some information on how the process works at the PUC and whether he thought it was realistic to go to 150-day goal for all pipeline requests, and I think he can provide us with some information on the topic. Mr. Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Dan Wolf, Assistant Executive Secretary with the Public Utilities Commission. Thank you for the opportunity. As you know, as the Chair knows, the Commission does not, being a quasi-judicial body, we do not oppose or support legislation, but we do certainly want to provide information where that is appropriate, and I think in this case, I think it might be helpful to the committee as it considers this particular piece of legislation. What the page is handing out is a, and I, there may be a way to put this up on the screen, but I don't know how to do it. But we've got at least a hard copy of a flowchart that describes the current process. You're looking right at me.
We've never used this form of technology.
No. Focus. What I've got is a flowchart that tries to, in a very concise manner, one page, describe the current process. And I think it's...
I can set it down on the white.
Might
be better focus. Oh, maybe. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Anyway, you've got the handout, and I brought extra copies as well. But I just wanted to describe the current process so that you can understand what's involved here and try and get a sense of the time frames needed for the process. So once an application for a pipeline route is filed with the commission needs to make a determination whether or not that application is complete under the statutes and the rules. That is not a determination on the merits, but it's certainly, but it is merely a determination that all of the requested information is contained in the application. As part of that process, we do ask the Department of Commerce to comment on that. We think that's appropriate, despite the last comments that you heard, because they represent the public interest, and we want to know if in fact, all of the information that is required is contained in that application so that the both Commerce and the PUC, as well as the public, can have an opportunity to fully analyze that information. Once it is considered complete, the matter is then starts the process of consideration. And as you can see on the icons, we've got the stars for public comment opportunities, and we've got the triangle. I'm not sure exactly what that is, but for a public meeting. So the next step in the process, again, not on the merits, of the pipeline itself, but our public information meetings, by law, they are required to be in every county in which the pipeline is proposed to run through. So in the current one, in the Sandpiper pipeline in northern Minnesota, that's a number of counties, and there needs to be a public hearing in each one of those counties. And the purpose of these meetings is to consider alternative routes. Again, it's not yet on the merits. And I think the newspaper article that we'll mention a little bit more, but the newspaper article on Saturday, there's some confusion in northern Minnesota about that. This, at this point, is not on the merits, but is merely to ask for alternative routes for the commission to consider. As you can see, it's an opportunity for public comment, and it's also a public meeting, as I said, in every county in which the pipeline would run. Once there is a comment process and an opportunity for review of that, the commission then needs to meet again and make a determination on what alternative routes need to be considered, because that's instructive to the Department of Commerce. As you can see, the next arrow down on that shaded purple side there. Once the commission has decided which alternative routes to consider in addition to the one proposed by the company, the Department of Commerce goes through an environmental report, which is looking at those alternatives from the environmental standpoint and reports back to the commission on that. I should say here, this process is only talking about the permitting process, not the certificate of need process, which is a totally separate but parallel process that is running during the same time frame. Once those alternative routes are determined, the matter is referred to the Office of Administrative Hearings for an administrative law judge to conduct public hearings again within every county in which the proposed pipeline would run. That, as you can see, again, is an opportunity for the public to comment, and again, is a public meeting. In addition to those public meetings, for the public to have a chance to understand what's being proposed and a chance for them to make comments, there's also an evidentiary hearing, which is like a trial. It's a contested case proceeding in which the parties will present witnesses, evidence, opportunity for cross-examination. Coming out of that process, the administrative law judge makes a report to the commission. And under the current rules, there is a time frame in which parties can take exceptions to the judge's report. The judge got this right, the judge got that wrong, we would do it this way. An opportunity for those comments for the commission to consider, and then it goes back to the commission for decision. And again, as you can see, it's an opportunity for a public meeting and public comment. So there's a lot of steps involved in this process. And I guess one of the things that we would be looking for is direction from the legislature. If you want to speed this process up, and I'm asking this quite sincerely, if you want to speed this process up, what part of this do you not want? Do you not want public meetings in the proposed project area? Do you not want environmental review? I mean, I think some policy choices have to be made to decide how to shorten this time frame up. You mentioned, Madam Chair, the article in the Saturday paper. I note with some irony that while we're hearing from some folks that it takes too long, and this is about a 12-month process, but while you're hearing from some people that this takes too long, as those of you who read that article, there are neighborhood groups up there. There's, in fact, a county board that passed a resolution. They're asking us to delay this, to elongate the process so that there's more opportunity for public comment, more opportunity for public understanding. So I guess maybe, you know, if one side thinks it's too short and one side thinks it's too long, maybe we're kind of in the middle here and we're doing something close to right anyway. The other parallel that was made here, comparison that was made, was, well, we've done this for environmental permitting, DNR, PCA, et cetera. The governor's on board with that. It's been bipartisan. That's the model we should adopt. And I guess I would note, and again, it's up to the legislature, but I would note there's a very real distinction between what the commission does and what an agency does in that regard. As you can see through this flowchart, these are very involved with public hearings, public opportunity for comments. If you're looking at some other agencies, and I'm not trying to throw anybody under the bus here, but I mean, if they're conducting a staff review and then an office review by a commissioner who makes a decision, that does not necessarily involve those public hearings. Obviously, you can do that on a much, much more expedited basis. So we are very different at the PUC because we are required by law to have those public hearings that take public input. Anybody can provide comment in the records, which we take, and then we have a public meeting at the end of this, at the last diamond down there, where it's, again, a public meeting, chance for public comment, and a open meeting law requires that the commissioners not talk about it beforehand, so we have no idea what the decisions will be until they reach those decisions. So again, we at the commission value public input. We value the opportunity for the public to know what's going on. We certainly want to have that environmental review, and so we can do whatever you tell us to do, but I think it just involves some choices at the legislative level.
Thank you, Mr. Wolf. Questions from members for Representative Plum or commentary? Representative Seltzer.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wolf, thank you for providing this flow chart. This is very helpful in understanding the complexity of what the legislature, the government requires. I'm wondering, you know, if we start with the application accepted, I think one of the testifiers talked about it being weeks and you never know when it's going to be accepted or rejected. So I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that process and about how long it takes and why it takes that long.
Yep. Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for that question. As I said, the application needs to contain all the information required by statute and by the rules. And so the first determination made by the commission, and it is a full, it's not a, certainly the staff assist in that review, but it's not a determination made by the staff. That is a public meeting. It's a determination made by the commission itself that the application is complete and that the matter needs to be referred to the Office of Administrative Hearings. It depends upon the application. Some of those can take a couple of weeks to determine that they're complete and bring them up before the commission for that decision. Others take longer. In the instance of the Sandpiper situation, it has taken a couple of months, and that's because the department was objected to the information that was contained and said it was not complete and that there was more information needed. The applicant said that it was protected under federal law, and so we had to get a protective order issued from the Office of Administrative Hearings so that the Department of Commerce and the commission staff could see that information but it not be publicly accessible in our docketing system. So this one, the current one on the Sandpiper line, has taken a couple of months, but typically it is a couple of weeks. And as I said, we're not required by statute or by rule to seek comments on whether an application is complete or not, but we usually grant that to the department because we value their input.
Follow-up, Representative Seltzer.
Thank you. And I was I'd have a question for Representative Quam. I'm wondering I just was curious, where does the 30 days and the 150 days come from? How did you determine to use those two 30 business days of application for a permit to be approved and then 150 days for the whole process?
Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, Representative Seltzer. Basically, I thought we would start at some place that we agreed on a similar process, familiar language, and then try to adapt it to the PUC. And basically starting at a point that we had agreement on for another related process, and then looking at and having the discussion like we're having this evening, what are the differences and how should we adapt it? So going from 5 months proposed to, you know, presently it's around 12, looking at the process and saying, well, what is parallel or series that can be done? What are the I asked the revisor, my intent was to get rid of rinse and repeat and to, you know, look at that process. And so this is starting with something to get the discussion going and then having us look at the process and decide where we should look, the initial section of reporting is fairly, you know, repetitive to a year. I envision that it would be ramping down and sunsetting as we go through the, you know, have the PUC look at where they could maybe hold some of these, if you got 10 counties, hold things in, you know, more parallel, hold several in, you know, two in a week or three in a week, etc., so that you don't stretch it out because you're scheduling long durations between. You know, that is, it's basically let's have this discussion and amend and come up with something we can, I guess, you know, agree upon as the final result. But if I had picked out something that was, you know, more arbitrary than something familiar, then I'm not sure where we'd be starting would be, you know, too far or not.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wolf, has the PUC ever flat out denied a pipeline route permit? Just, no, we're not going to do this. We're done. Go back to the drawing board. We're finished. You don't get your permit.
Mr. Wolf.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not sure. I would have to ask staff that question that works on this in our facilities permitting staff.
Okay. Well, I know in the solid waste area, which I'm most familiar with, it's very rare that a permit's denied, and my guess is it's rare here. So to paraphrase or quote Mr. Johnson, who's in the back, I've always wanted to say this. Madam Chair, I have grave concerns about this. I think that it's sort of a solution in search of a problem. I think that, you know, I would probably side on the we ought to have a little bit more process in this, because really what is sacrificed by what we did last year, which I opposed and voted against, is it's the public piece of it. These are really, really important issues that are being discussed. Need for projects, environmental impacts of projects, and it's the public that gets shut down and gets shut out. And so you have people with considerable resources behind closed doors making decisions. And that's what worries me and concerns me, not only about this bill, but, you know, some of the unsession bills have this in. And we, in that, you know, the legislation that we passed last year had this in. So, you know, I oppose it, and, you know, I would just encourage the PUC to continue to do all you can to engage and involve the public and have a very robust discussion of alternatives.
Any further questions from members? Representative Grafflo.
Thank you. Madam
and
Chair,
then we'll have Representative Quam wrap up and we'll vote. Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, first of all, I'll just say that as a matter of fact, not as a matter of opinion, pipelines are the safest, most environmentally responsible, and most cost-effective way to transport oil, natural gas, and other products. This is a fact. It is not in dispute. And we should be encouraging the development of these pipelines, not opposing them, to my friends. But, Madam Chair, this is an important issue. I'd request a roll call on this bill, and I would encourage members to vote yes.
Representative Garofalo requests a roll call. Representative Quam, would you like to say anything to wrap up?
Yes, I would, and that this, the whole intent was to look at the process. We've had what a lot of people have said have been success in implementing previous legislation. I realize that this is going to take a while to work through, but if no one steps up and starts this process, we don't get to the end result. And Representative Hornstein, maybe the end result is longer than what we've got. But, you know, frankly, if we don't look at what government's doing periodically, then I don't think we're doing justice to the citizens. And that's part of this intent. And I wish you would support continuing this effort and have a positive vote.
Thank you, Representative Quam. I will just note all the other permitting efficiency bills took months of back and forth between the members carrying the bills and the agencies, and I appreciate you've just started the conversation. The clerk will take the roll.
Portman?
No.
Morgan?
No.
Garofalo?
Yes.
Allen? Atkins? Beard? Falk?
No.
Hackbarth? Hornstein?
No.
Kelly? Mason?
No.
Quam?
C.
Scott?
Yes.
Seltzer?
No.
And Yaruso?
No.
There being a vote of 3 ayes and 7 nays, the motion does not prevail, and the bill is not re-referred. And tomorrow we're having the Garofalo show. We have removed the Hortman bill from the agenda, so I think we have 3 or 4 Garofalo bills.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. And I think we should be able to finish between 12:30 and 2, and we will not have to have a hearing on Thursday morning from 8 to 10. Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, and just to update members on something that's going on, you might hear some actually, I could get members' attention. I'm actually talking to you guys over there that are talking
members.
To each other.
DFLers, Representative Garofalo wants to tell you something.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. So just really quickly, there's a bill up tomorrow that's an EV bill that I'm carrying. This is with the tariff. There is a dispute right now. There's not peace in the valley on this bill. It's the issue of how munis and co-ops are going to be treated in it. I would just encourage you to talk to the advocates on both sides of the aisle to see if they can reach a compromise on this. Because right now there's opposition and strong support for that provision. I just don't want anyone to be surprised when we come into committee tomorrow. If there's not resolution on that, there's probably going to be an extensive debate and a large amount of public testimony. So if we can incentivize the stakeholders to reach an agreement on that, it'd be better for everybody on the committee.
And Representative Garofalo, you intend to go forward with your bill?
Yeah. All right. Unless I'm told otherwise.
Nope. Great. I think I'm a co-author. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the consideration of the previous bill. I did want to clarify the earlier questions about compact fluorescence. I think they're a flawed interim technology that isn't good for the environment. I buy LEDs, and I just am trying to get people to realize that there are hazardous materials and, you know, look for something better.
We're on the same page on that note. Representative Quam, thank you for that. This meeting is adjourned.